everyone. Thank you for coming to the Joint Committee on Marijuana Legalization meeting for November 16th, 2015. We are meeting for 3 hours today, and as many of the folks who come to these meetings regularly know, it's a great thing that we're starting at 2 instead of later. So we have, to preview the order, we're going to switch it up a little bit from what is on what you may have seen. We're going to start with OHA, then go to OLCC, then go to an update from local government folks, and then go to the industry panel, and then in fifth position, the Department of Agriculture and Department of Revenue updates. I'm going to try to keep us moving forward so that everyone gets enough time. We sort of crunched some folks out at the end of the agenda last time, and we want to try to avoid that. Thank you to the community members who've come down to testify. We really appreciate everyone being in the room for this. And with that, I'll open the informational hearing on a variety of good issues and invite the Oregon Health Authority to come forward. We have Priscilla Lewis, Deputy Director, to be talking about temporary rules and how early start is going, and you've brought with you your counsel. So welcome, both of you.
I have a presentation.
Please state your name for the record.
All right, can you hear me? Yeah, I speak softly, so I apologize. So thank you for welcoming us. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Priscilla Lewis. I'm Deputy Director for Public Health, Division of Oregon Health Authority, and I appreciate the invitation to come back and talk to you again about implementation of House Bill 3400. Today I'm going to focus on updating you on the activities of the Public Health Division since I presented at the end of September. We will continue to work closely. We have continued to work closely with our state partners at OLCC, ODA, I would like to add Department of Revenue to that, on a number of issues related to medical and retail sales of marijuana. Also, you'll hear that the start of marijuana sales to the general public through dispensaries happened under our watch. It happened October 1st, and we're happy to report the Oregonian described it as a non-event. So with that, as I mentioned when I presented last before you, our role in public health really remains protecting the public's health, regulating dispensaries, and accrediting laboratories for testing. We do have a new role from House Bill 3400, which required us to establish serving size and labeling to protect the public's health. And I'll provide you the details about that work today. In terms of rulemaking, you can go ahead. In terms of rulemaking, Retail Fast Track was the first rulemaking we were engaged in per House Bill 8844, which we established rules that allowed sales of limited amounts of marijuana as of October 1st. 83% of dispensaries took part in Fast Start, dispensaries that were registered with us at the time. Approximately 5% of dispensaries were not able to participate, and that was because of local bans. As I mentioned, this was generally a non-event. Dispensaries open and with adults age 21 and over who wanted to purchase products from these stores were able to. Inspections, when we spoke at the end of September, we were not fully staffed, but knowing we would not be fully staffed for inspections, we did deploy our emergency preparedness staff. We have 7 staff members that we trained, and we were able to visit most of the dispensaries in the areas where we serve. By the end of this month, 9 of our 12 inspectors will be hired, and we are in the process of training that first cohort now. There was one major issue that came up on October 1st. You may have read about it in the media. A dispensary did have a vendor on site who was giving away products outside and without checking identification, and the products were not properly packaged. That dispensary was issued a civil penalty and will be on probation. There have been additional actions that have been taken, that have taken place since October 1st at different locations. Overall, though, the inspectors tell us that most dispensaries are acting responsibly and following the rules and regulations and attempting to do so to the best of their abilities. We do have a website that reports all of the actions that we've taken. In addition, today, a letter will be coming out jointly between OHA and OLCC, letting all of our dispensary owners know that we will be working collaboratively as OLCC begins their implementation of registration. So this Friday, this past Friday, OHA issued temporary rules on labeling, serving size, and laboratory accreditation and testing. And I'll provide you a little bit of background about each of those individual areas. So for labeling, OHA is required to write the rules around labeling and serving size for all retail and medical products. We worked with an OLCC technical advisory committee over the summer and took public comments and early drafts and issued those temporary rules on Friday. These rules require what must be on the principal display label, as well as the ingredient label, and rely on a process whereby OLCC will pre-approve all labels and any label changes. In addition, there will be child resistance for each of the packaging for marijuana products. Serving size is the next area. Per House Bill 3400, a serving size has been established that applies for both medical and retail. We do address them separately. For solid retail edible products that can be scored, we established a serving size of 5 milligrams of THC and a maximum package size of 50 milligrams for retail marijuana. A product that can be scored is a semi-solid product that is solid enough to display that scoring. If a product cannot be scored, the serving size is still 5 milligrams, but the maximum package size is 10 milligrams. Products that cannot be scored include liquids and products such as ice cream and honey. So that will be essentially two servings in any total serving size. On the medical side, based upon public feedback, we established a maximum package size of 100 milligrams. The 5 milligram serving and 50 milligram package was developed based on suggestions from our science advisory committee, which looked at serving size in Colorado and Washington. Essentially, they adopted a standard which is half of the limits of those two states. The issue of serving size has received substantial public interest, and particularly interest from the pediatric community over the concern about possible ingestion of edibles, particularly by children. By adopting this serving size and total serving size that is half of Colorado's experience or Washington, we feel that we've set a safe limit. But we will continue to monitor this closely with our pediatric community. And in next month's dashboard, and we hope moving forward, we will report calls to poison control around children ingesting cannabis or marijuana products to this committee. Internally, as I said, we had significant discussions about serving size, and we will be monitoring this closely. Our Rules Advisory Committee for OHA is also going to take up this issue prior to the adoption of permanent rules for an entire session. So for laboratory testing is another area where we've been working closely with OLCC and also the Department of Agriculture. Our lab responsibility is to determine what to test for and to establish action levels for contaminants. We will also accredit laboratories that will do the testing, and that accreditation starts in January. I think that's another area where we have received some press about prior laboratories. Into the future, all laboratories who test marijuana will be accredited. These laboratories are private laboratories, and although OHA and ODA both have laboratories that may do testing in certain circumstances, including outbreak investigations and around pesticide issues. And what will we test for? Items that will be tested for will include pesticides, contaminants like E. coli and Salmonella, solvents used to extract or concentrate cannabis active ingredients, homogeneity for edibles, our water content, as well as levels of THC and CBD. I wanted to also talk a little bit about our Rules Advisory Committee. OHA has formed its own Rule Advisory Committee. All of these temporary rules are being worked through our Rules Advisory Committee, which had its second meeting today. This committee will help us make all of the temporary rules permanent and as well as develop new rules moving into the future. This committee includes representatives from growers, processors, dispensaries, cardholders, public health, the medical community, as well as the general public. So as we report almost on a monthly basis, we are, this is our trend in card applications. Our reporting of data has about a 2-month lag, and so I have been asked about that. This is our most current, and we do continue to rise, and the most current verbal report I've gotten from the program is we currently have approximately 76,000 cardholders. As well, this is our new and existing dispensary renewals. We peaked in March and have continued to decline. And then finally, I wanted to talk, and this is why Shannon is up here with me. We wanted to talk a little bit about some of the challenges that we are facing as we implement the rest of our rules, particularly rules around growers and processors, which are new for OHA's authority. So under our current rules, OHA, and on the medical side going forward, we have limited product tracking authority. And without enhanced tracking authority, there is potential for particularly product on the medical side for health and safety concerns, as well as diversion risks within the medical marijuana supply chain. OLCC on the retail side has seed-to-sale tracking. What we have authority for is significantly less, and it does create that potential within the medical market going forward. Another area where we are struggling in this new environment is the confidentiality of grow sites. Currently, grow site addresses are confidential for medical and on OHA's side. This does impact our ability to work with law enforcement when needed, and it will also impact our ability to work with ODA going forward. Data sharing among agencies. The Department of Revenue needs expressed authority to share tax information with OHA and to enable regulators to enforce issues related to tax delinquency. Again, this is an area where we could use your help. And then finally, grandfathering of growers, which I know was a priority of Senator Burdick's. Under our current system, as we're trying to work through the development of the rules, one patient's application at a grow site with multiple patients has the potential to adversely impact other growers and patients with no prior notification based upon the two standards for grandfathering and residency. And I think finally the solution to all of this was OHA would propose decoupling cardholders from growers. In the prior environment, I think it made sense. In this new environment, it does not make sense, and it creates significant operational challenges for us moving forward. That completes my formal testimony. I'm open for questions.
Yes, Co-Chair Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you elaborate a little bit on how the decoupling would work if we for those grow sites? Because I was concerned about the implementation of the grandfathering requirement.
Mm-hmm. Co-Chair Senator Burdick, Shannon O'Fallon with the Oregon Department of Justice. I've been assisting the Oregon Health Authority on drafting rules to implement some of the provisions in House Bill 3400. And in particular, the grow site grandfathering is proving problematic. I think one of the ways in which sort of the decoupling could happen is you could maintain a patient-grower relationship if a grower was not growing for more than two patients. And so that would allow you to have up to 12 plants at a location. If you wanted to grow for more patients than that, then growers would get together, and it would be similar to a dispensary application or a processor application. Any owners or individuals responsible for that site would all apply together, have sort of, you know, joint ownership and responsibility for that grow site. The legislature could decide how many plants would be permitted at the grow site. And then those grow sites would only be able to sell to processors, to OHA-registered processors or dispensaries. And so dispensaries then, in turn, would only be able to accept transfers from OHA-registered growers that are growing at these specific grow sites or from OHA processors. So that might be one solution where you would be able to maintain on a small level the patient-grower relationship, but if you were doing it on any sort of a grander scale, then, you know, you wouldn't, and the plants then at those grow sites would not be owned by a patient anymore. They would just belong to the growers and would be available to sell.
Yes. And I kind of heard a similar concept in the context of co-locating. In other words, if you had the potential for growers who are selling only to dispensaries or processors to co-locate, then they could switch to seed to sale, be separated from the card system, and go ahead and sell into dispensaries. But part of the grandfathering provision was to get the plant count down to 48 plants, the maximum for the people who aren't grandfathered in, over a period of time. So if you still wanted that policy option to get everybody down to 48, because the way it is in the bill is, you know, once a cardholder leaves the system, then they don't get replaced until you get down to the 48 plant level. So how would that work in a decoupling environment?
Chair Burdick, it seems to me that if you have the decoupling, I don't know that you would necessarily need to do the grandfathering. The legislature could just decide what the limits should be at those grow site locations. I don't know that you would need, because I wasn't considering the two to sort of be in concert. Because you wouldn't, again, if you had these sort of grow site registration applications that were separate, you wouldn't be growing for a certain number of patients anymore. You wouldn't have a certain number of plants per patient. You would just have whatever number of plants the legislature authorized at those locations.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question about accreditation of the laboratories. How long is it going to take to get all the participating labs accredited?
So application to be accredited is voluntary on the part of the laboratories, and it does take significant effort for a laboratory to be accredited. We anticipate that by the date whereby it would be required, We have the capacity within ORLAP and OHA to accredit it, to accredit up to 8 laboratories, which would be adequate. But again, it is going to depend upon the laboratories choosing and wishing to be accredited. They could, so that would be 8 if they started completely de novo. Some of the laboratories may already be accredited with ORLAP, but not for cannabis. Does that make sense?
So, well, if I could follow up, I guess a question would be, what comfort then will the customer have in accreditation? Will it be consistent?
Yes. This is an internationally recognized program that is currently run in conjunction with Oregon Public Health, DEQ, and Department of Ag. Mm-hmm. So we accredit labs across 50 states and even some international labs. So it's a well-respected, accredited, or recognized laboratory accreditation. So there, if products coming out for testing, consumers can be very confident that to the best of anyone's ability that they are tested appropriately.
Okay, thank you. Just a final follow-up here. You've listed pesticides, contaminant solvents, and then, of course, THC and CBD measurements here. Is there anything else that you would test for if you could, but it makes it prohibitive to add that to the list?
I would have to defer to our toxicologists or lab experts, but they have not indicated to me that there's anything else.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Brzozinski.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I was just wondering if I can just follow up with what Representative Wilson was on. Accreditation, Lynn, only 8. What does that mean? Only 8 labs will be able to be accredited? Or?
No, I took Representative Wilson's question as a capacity issue. How many labs do we think we could have accredited if they started completely from scratch? What is our capacity volume to actually get labs through the accreditation process? Ultimately, as many labs as apply and pass, we can accredit. But I was taking it as by June 1.
By June 1 of 2016?
Correct.
That's all I have on that one. Thank
you. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Ms. Liz, just want to clarify the recommendation to decouple medical marijuana growers and patients. That's the agency's recommendation, not the rules advisory committee recommendation. Is that correct?
That's the agency's recommendation.
Thank you. And has there been, may I follow?
Yes, please.
Has there been any research done on how that would impact access to for low-income medical marijuana patients in order to access marijuana if there are fewer growers or fewer access to people growing directly for patients in the medical marijuana market?
No, we have not done that research yet. But no. But we would attempt to at least do some estimates prior to drafting those rules.
If I ask one more?
Please, yes.
If the problem is stated is that a patient who leaves the market or leaves that grower's partnership, then the grandfathering system happens that might impact other patients and other growers. Aren't there other ways that we could address this by simply saying things like the grandfathering takes place in the next harvest season, or there has to be some sort of advance notice before the plant reduction comes in? It seems like there might be other ways besides disrupting the grower-patient relationship.
So, Co-Chairs, Representative Buckley, the in-house bill 3400, the plant limits, my reading of the bill is the plant limits and the grandfathering go into effect on March 1st of 2016, and they say that if a patient decides to sort of de-designate a grower, that then the plant limit, you know, goes down by that many at the grow site. So I don't know, based on the statutory language, that's something that could be sort of put off. It's not just, though, that you know, losing a patient is going to affect the rest of the grow site. I mean, setting up the grandfathering and from the very beginning is going to affect grow sites. Because right now you have, right, no plant limits at grow sites. You have, you may have, you do have sites where you have many growers growing all at the same location. Because grow sites are registered through a patient application, the first patient application that comes in for a particular grow site, if their grower is not someone that's been growing there for a significant period of time, then that grow site's not going to be grandfathered, and OHA, I think, is going to have to say, okay, you can only have, you know, 12 or 48 plants at this grow site, and it's going to affect all the other growers.
I understand. I think it just comes down to, if I just make a comment, the kind of, in my view, the disruption of the patient-grower relationship for the convenience of being able to figure this out on an agency basis doesn't seem worth it to me. This is just my opinion. It seems like we might want to actually see how this plays out, or tweak the grandfathering mechanism to make it work if it actually does become a problem. But again, I think the intent was, if you are a new grower, you grow under the lower limits. And the intent was that would not impact any current patients, because the current patients are being served by a different grower. So if you switch growers, so I'm not quite sure what the adverse impact is, other than you're saying that there'll be fewer plants in a location, which is true, but I'm not sure how that impacts any patients that are currently receiving access to medical marijuana.
So if I may, co-chairs, Representative Buckley, right, the new grower at a grow site address, mm-hmm, is limiting the number of plants that you can have at that address.
Correct.
So you can't have grandfathered growers and new growers growing at the same address. You're going to be stuck with the lower limit. So I guess I'm not understanding how that new grower isn't going to impact everybody else there at that grow site location, because the number of plants you're going to have are either going to be 12 or 48.
I would assume the new grower would have to be at a different location.
Mm-hmm.
Co-chairs, Representative Buckley, that could be, but I don't think there's any basis for the Oregon Health Authority refusing to register a grower at that grow site address because of that fact. So that's right. So
that's good.
That's some of the
good
problem.
Dig.
I have two questions. I'm not seeing my colleagues raising their hands at the moment. One, to make sure I understand the testing rules that apply and when accreditation applies. So from House Bill 3400, my understanding is that as of June 2016, adult use product has to be tested from certified labs based on those parameters, but that the adult use product being sold now from dispensaries, and possibly anything being sold from dispensaries now, does not have to be tested in accordance with those requirements, which sound really good and positive. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the gap. You know, right now, people in the community who are sick and vulnerable are some of the biggest consumers of legal sales product, but we're not testing that product. Is there a date by which all of the product gets tested? Is it purely voluntary between now and June 2016? Is that what I was hearing you say?
Let me address that. Chair Leininger, so the testing, the temporary rules were filed on Friday. They are effective in January. So, and my understanding is that there are labs that are applying or shortly are going to apply for accreditation now. So there's nothing stopping them from being accredited. Then once they're accredited, absolutely labs and growers and processors and dispensaries can send product for sampling and testing. The June 1 date was chosen because that's when folks thought that there would be enough accreditation capacity for all the product to be tested so that dispensaries would have something to sell. So there's nothing that would stop the industry from having products tested in accordance with the new rules prior to June 1. And the June 1 date then is just at that point for dispensaries. You're probably not going to have retail stores open yet, but dispensaries wouldn't be able to accept a transfer or transfer any product that didn't meet the new testing
after
requirements.
June 1. So it will apply to all dispensary
right.
products sold
yes.
as of June 1, and it can apply sooner as
yes.
as available. Okay.
Right. Or it can be a marketing advantage.
Uh-huh. So then the last question I have, and then I'd love to invite Senator Brzozinski to make a comment. We had in Section 117 of 3400, we included a requirement that that the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Education and the Governor's Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission work together to develop a prevention and education curriculum to make sure that youth don't mistake legal adult use sales to mean that it's permissible for youth. And we had asked that the first report be on or before February 2016. So we're getting close to that time. Could you tell me, please, what steps you're taking to develop an education and prevention campaign? I know OLCC is doing some great work, and maybe you're coordinating with them, but I'd love to invite you to describe the steps that OHA is taking.
So we do have a an OHA subcommittee that is working completely on that topic. What I would suggest is they come with me to the next presentation. I don't have a lot of details other than we have, I know that we are using materials from Colorado that have been particularly successful. I think our tobacco prevention program and within public health, our health promotion and prevention division is working with them significantly. But I have not seen the latest on their materials, and I know that they are not ready yet. But they can. I'm sure we could come, bring them, and do a presentation at our next meeting.
Okay, thank you, Senator Brzozinski.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I have about four areas that they've gone over. I had a question or two, if I could. The first one is following up, which we've already had other members ask about the decoupling and the cardholders and the grandfathering. I guess I heard what Representative Buckley said, and I guess my perspective, it seems like we're trying to fix something that I'm not sure it's really a problem to the point that we need to somehow create a division or an elimination of the patient-growers relationship. I mean, that's one thing that we have stated from this committee that we really wanted to make certain everything's going to work before we start doing this kind of decoupling, knowing that we've got 14 years of this program being up and running and not sure how it's going to transition for those patients who have been getting product at no cost or very low cost to something that they're now forced into a market. Could you give us a little bit more explanation as to, one, are you asking us to do that during the 2016 session, or are we just kind of having this as a heads up for let's see what happens, and then come 2017 we may be back regarding this issue?
So I'm going to turn to Shannon for some additional detail. I think for the 2016 session, my understanding or our advice is that we're asking for some simple help with some of the clarification of the language. Moving forward, though, operationally with 10,400 growers or close to 1,100 medical growers, it is challenging to maintain a robust transparent system with that large number of growers. And simply operationally, we think we could do a better job if they were decoupled.
Okay. Did you have a follow-up question? You had a couple of questions. Shannon,
we can talk more about this in detail. Just getting the perspective. So you've also stated that you'd like to be able to start sharing information that's currently confidential at the health authority with OLCC, I'm assuming, and Department of Ag and law enforcement. When the initiative was passed by the voters, it called for confidentiality that site information for multiple reasons. I'm trying to figure out what has changed to your point to think that we now need to open this up and go against the will of the voters.
Well, I think in an environment where the only purpose for growing was a medical market. It made sense for the confidentiality issues, but now it is an open market, and it will be very challenging to determine whether it's a retail site, a medical site, or a completely unlicensed site. And so that makes our ability to communicate with other agencies much more important.
Well, let me just follow up on that, if I may. It seems to me that with the seed to sell that's already under recreational OLCC, they're going to know exactly what's coming in or going out from their facilities into an authorized selling perspective. I'm cautious about us opening this up because at this point, if let's say law enforcement, the way it works now, they can call and ask whether or not this is a authorized grow site. So there's nothing to stop us from being able to get that information that way, as compared to just opening it up for anyone to be looking in whatever capacity they may want to be looking at. So that's more of a
We're not proposing that kind of open environment, but some greater flexibility would be very helpful for the agency.
Right, and two more if I can just follow.
Sure, and then I'm going to ask that by about quarter till we transition to the next panel, so please go ahead.
So on the tracking, are you now coming back before us and asking this committee to authorize a seed-to-sell tracking program for the medical program?
I will speak for my agency. We are not asking for that, but we see the wisdom in it, and maybe I'll let Shannon speak to it. It is very challenging operationally without seed to sale, particularly around product purity when we're putting things through a tested laboratory. Without seed to sale, there are opportunities for dirty product to come back into a system that does not have seed to sale, and also for diversion, which has been addressed previously. Seed to sale is much tighter system, and we recognize that. Our ability to build a comparable system internally is very challenging.
I understand. The last question was on the serving size, 5 milligrams versus 10. I understand from your presentation that you basically just cut in half what is currently acceptable and available in Colorado and Washington State. Why did you come up with that number, and on what basis did you come up with that number as compared to what's happening, and what are the horror stories with 10 milligrams versus 5?
So it is not a case of simply cutting it in half. It is a case, as you know, there is very limited information about THC impact on use and impact on children. What little bit of information we do have, we have gotten from Colorado Poison Control. And the 5 milligrams was the cautious approach to Colorado Poison Control's experience. 10 milligrams for a 2-year-old child is a lot. We are hoping within 6 months, and actually I just talked to our own Poison Control prior to coming in here. We're hopeful within 6 months that we will have some THC limits per kilogram of a child's weight to come back with and have more scientific data. But it was not simply cutting it in half.
Right. Lastly, if I could, sure. And that's basically, if you're proposing that for medical marijuana, are you going to be also asking us for authority to reduce the size and serving portions of other prescribed medicines that can be extremely harmful to children?
No, and actually I should restate it. I want to be clear. The 5 and 50 is for retail. Because of the needs of our medical clients, we have allowed greater flexibility with the medical clients.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much. So we look forward to hearing from you next time through. We appreciate all your work.
Thank you.
Now we would like to invite forward some representatives from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, Rob Patridge, whom I believe is having a birthday today.
Oh.
So this seems like a great way to celebrate. who's chair of the OLCC, Stephen Marks, who's the director of the OLCC, and Will Higland, who's the director of licensing and compliance. Welcome, gentlemen. We look forward to hearing your presentation and having a conversation afterwards.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody. For the record, I'm Rob Patridge. I'm the chair of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Happy to be here today to walk you through kind of where we've been in recent history related to our outreach efforts and our ability to put rules in place. We've had a great partnership, I believe, with the legislature, with our law enforcement and local government partners, as well as this new emerging industry. And that's what we've strived to do at the OLCC. We've done a lot of public outreach, and we'll kind of walk you through some of those things real quick. So just so you're all aware, in September we reported to you that there are 800,000 hits on marijuana.oregon.gov. As of recently, there were 1.14 million hits on that website, which is huge, as you may know, for a government website. Our government delivery, meaning our email service that goes out where we can get subscribers, has jumped from 16,000 in September to 29,000. Our online survey, we've made you aware that there were 16,500 people who participated in about a week-long period. You all know that we did our listening tour with 11 cities, 3,000 participants to be involved in the industry. Since we were before you, to a great degree before, we put in place our Rules Advisory Committee. We didn't have to do that as part of a temporary rules process, but we did do that because we thought it was critically important. I think that we were able to build a lot of great partnerships during that process and vet out the rules that will ultimately make passing the final rules a lot easier process. I'm glad we took the time. We had over 38 meetings, and we had 100 plus different participants in those meetings. They were hard fought, and a lot of that stuff is online. If you ever want to go back and look at some of the history as you go through and consider more deliberative process as you go into the February session. In terms of our temporary rules public hearing, we held not only did we have all these rules advisory committees meet, but the OLCC chose to have a public hearing to let everybody come forward to talk to us about the rules. We didn't have a great set of draft rules at that point in time, but because of timing to try and hit the deadlines that we've given this body, we had a rules public hearing on October 9th. We had scheduled till 5 o'clock, and I think we ended about 4 o'clock, and everybody who wanted to come and be heard got heard. And I think that was a testament to the hard work of our staff and the industry and everybody else, that we didn't exhaust the time and go further into the evening because we had worked very, very hard and diligently on our rules advisory committees. October 22nd, about 3 weeks ago, we did adopt our temporary rules. We are in the process of just doing, we will have some technical fixes to those rules that will be in front of the commission on our Friday meeting. We have a Friday meeting at OLCC that are, I think, meet with what the intent of what we were doing was. But, you know, as we read into these things, we'll fix it. I think there's like four things that we're going to fix there for technical things. We're in the process now of creating a law enforcement advisory group as well as a business subcommittee. In addition to that, because of the work of this committee and because what we're trying to do, we're trying to get the bandwidth, but I'm committed as the chair to put in place really a student advisory committee, which would be an ad hoc committee to OLCC, not only just on the marijuana stuff, but also on the alcohol and marijuana stuff, kind of on an ongoing basis. We're just trying to find the bandwidth to do that in the midst of everything else we have going, but we think that will be a good input. Our permanent rulemaking will begin in January, and we expect to have the rules adopted by June 28th to get things moving. Just to give you kind of a high-level view of the chapters that went into the temporary rules, we had the application license requirements, we had the producer license requirements, processor license, wholesaler, retail license requirements, retail delivery, laboratory license requirements, a research certificate piece, producer opt-ins, marijuana handlers permits, record keeping and inventory tracking, security, transportation, waste disposal, what we're going to do for a minor control pen, packaging, advertising, and compliance and a sanction schedule. So all those things are in our temporary rules package. I think it's about a 70-plus page packet at this point in time. If you want light reading, go for it. I also want to thank Shannon O'Fallon for putting up with us from Department of Justice. She was just here. She's put in a lot of extra time and hours to walk us through that. And having five independent commissioners, it takes a little bit of time on, just like it does with legislators. So legislative council feels it, I'm sure, too. But, one of the main issues, and obviously we heard from you all on residency, was a huge issue. I think that we tried to follow what was in the statute that was passed, and at the same time try and strike a balance to allow the legislature to make things happen. I hope that during the February session, you all can accomplish what your intent is. I think that we have preserved people's place in line. I think that it was good conversation. I think I got to talk to most of you, and it was great because Representative Leininger and I happened to be at the Oregon Judicial Conference that day when we cooked up that brainchild to try and make sure that your legislative intent got transferred across, and I take it that you will take that up in February to try and address that. I'm going to have Steve walk through a variety of things, but I think you all know we sent a letter to you, all of you, November 2nd, related to a variety of things, but we'll go through those a little bit later. But I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Marks on what we're doing on canopy limits and some other things.
Very good. For the record, Steve Marks, Executive Director of OLCC. So I have the assignment of talking to you about the few issues. Canopy limits was an issue we took up. As you know, we had little direction around that, but the legislature had an intent that we tried to make the indoor and outdoor grows equivalent. We kind of set ourselves at a 4-to-1 ratio. There are people that think it's 6-to-1, even 8-to-1. But we did set the indoor tiers at 5,000 for tier 1 and 10,000 for tier 2. For outdoor, it's 20,000 square feet on Tier 1, and for Tier 2, 40,000 square feet. So just under a half acre and just under an acre. Greenhouses would be, since we didn't have a category to put greenhouses into, we distinguished how they would be counted by how much artificial light or if artificial light was used in the growing process. In our rules, we did provide for local governments to request of OLCC to petition us for larger canopy sizes. I think that was really put in there for us to think about what the role of planning at the local level really is in our process and in the control of land use planning in local jurisdictions. With that, I think switch to the next issue is fees. You know, we didn't have a lot of data we reported to you before. It was going to be hard to understand exactly where we are. We do have a $250 application fee on entry for the rules. Generally, our average for the license type is $4,750. Now, because the rules called for us to balance out our costs with our licensing fees, and it did it by license type. When we got to the tiers on grow, tier 1 and tier 2 on grow, we split that $1,000 difference there. So you have the lower tier 1 at $3,750 and the higher tier at $5,750. Our letter mentions we're looking for some help here to make this administrative part of the process work a little more smoothly. Home delivery turned out to be, though it's statutorily authorized, turned out to be pretty controversial amongst our audience and our advisory groups, both marijuana retailers and the public safety forces joined forces on this one to say we wanted to really make this standard at its outset pretty de minimis in terms of delivery. We provided that the delivery would be allowed with value up to $100 on the product, and that would be a delivery within the jurisdictions that they were from.
Madam Chair, can we just get clarification that you said within the jurisdictions, meaning?
So I'm Our rules say, so meaning within your city or within your county, who your business licensing authority is.
And one of the questions we had during this process was trying to ensure where there may be a moratorium that individual patients would be able to have access. Does the rules provide for that?
Madam Chair, Senator Perzanski, because we weren't medical on this, we didn't, and we heard your discussion loud and clear. We were cognizant of it. We actually worked that requirement, but people thought that was really an indication for the medical system, not the recreational okay. system.
I stand corrected. Sorry.
Co-location, you know, we've talked before about co-location only. Really, we have a way for growers to opt in at the grow level. There is a no marriage here in the statute that we would want tracking. So our rules simply state that OLCC won't license at an OMMP registered location. Bring it up and brought it up last time we were before you. We are feeling the pressure for different integrations of the system. It's coming up a lot as you discuss retail. Edibles testing, packaging, and advertising. I think the committee is well versed in our various responsibilities between OLCC, OHA, and ODA within the system. I just characterize the rules we have in place as to set out to protect minors across these issues, particularly in packaging with child-resistant containers, and labeling to make sure that that labeling and the packaging is not attractive to minors as a feature of the rule, and that advertising cannot be targeted to minors. And then, of course, for our part, to protect consumers, we will label products in conjunction with OHA's rules. With that, I think I'm turning it back over to the chairman on our request for the session.
So, again, we did give you a letter dated November 2nd. I'm trying to highlight a little bit on what's going on there. There are some policy issues that we would ask from an administrative standpoint that you take a look at and decide kind of the direction that you want to go. One is the simplification of accounting for fees. Now we're trying to break it down by license type and then the cost to every single license type rather than the overall cost of the agency. So it makes trying to determine the fees really time consuming and difficult at each licensing level to try and figure that out. I think we're trying to figure it out overall from a fee standpoint. We'd ask that you give us a little bit broader authority rather than trying to assign, you know, 0.3 of this person's time and 0.4 of that person's time, because we feel like that's the mandate that's been given if we do that strictly. So we're trying to govern the overall program and try and govern by program unit, but by the same token, it makes it difficult from a fee setting standpoint for us especially. In addition to that, I think from a policy perspective, I think the legislature needs to decide ultimately, especially from an enforcement standpoint, state police, their budget is not based upon the number of tickets they write or the fees that are charged. And I think as you look at OLCC, especially as an enforcement agency in the marijuana context, do you want us to be at odds with industry related to raising fees over enforcement, or do you want to kind of decouple enforcement a little bit as you look at our agency into the future? I think that that's a long-term public policy issue that, you know, we want adequate, you want, I think, adequate public safety enforcement. By the same token, do you want to keep the fees up and down to do that? So that's an ongoing question for you. Timing of land use compatibility statements. I think both the counties and cities and local government, as well as the OLCC, and I think from the applicants generally that I've heard about, there's a requirement that the applicant to obtain the LUCs prior to submitting their application is kind of more the direction rather than OLCC having to go out and get the LUCs from the local jurisdiction. That would give the applicant some certainty rather than applying to OLCC and then it going that way. We would like to see it that way, and then OLCC could verify the LUCs is what we'd like to be able to do in that. Include consideration of certain misdemeanors as a license denial criteria for marijuana handlers permits. The way it's written today is basically we can't deny a marijuana handler's permit unless somebody's committed a felony. But if somebody's but you've moved the distribution of marijuana down to a Class A misdemeanor. So they could have been had Class A misdemeanors before, but for distribution, but they can still get a marijuana handler's permit. So we'd like to have a conversation about if they're, you know, if they're complying with the law, generally we can give them a handler's permit. We don't want to exclude everything, but we also don't want to license people who wantonly or have violated the marijuana laws of the state based upon the where the criminal statutes ended up. Startup resources, we continue to be, you know, this is a new area for everybody, so we are concerned about the adequacy of the startup resources. We'll be continuing to come back and forth with you as we're trying to put the program together and realize the nuance of that. But they could be higher than forecasted. We just carve that out as a side. We're trying to stay within budget, but by the same token, we want to do what's right. We have some technical fix cleanup, the tax language cleanup. Department of Revenue tracks the taxes. There's some cleanup that needs to go on there. The delegation authority, we'd like it to mirror the alcohol statute, so there's some clarity in the law. A little bit better there. For financial interest, I think that there's been, I know you guys have been lobbied regularly, and there's some interest in clarifying discretion and the materiality of the financial interest. Bonds, we had, when we originally had the tax collection, it would have been, we could have required bonding authority. That bonding authority should be transferred to Department of Revenue instead of OLCC. And then some things related to the timing issues for the liquor funds reimbursement. The legislature needs to address that because that does impact cities and counties as well as the legislature in terms of the payback over time. So with that, that's kind of overall what we've asked. There's obviously more detail in the letter, but we'd be open for questions. But we want to give you an update on the implementation, and Will is here. Higlin is here today, who's running the marijuana program, for the implementation update.
Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chairs, member of the committee. For the record, I am Will Higlin, the Senior Director of Licensing Compliance, and it's great to be with you today. It's hard to imagine, but we're about 6 or 7 weeks away from actually accepting our first application. So I wanted to give you a high overview today, kind of philosophically, what our plan is, let you ask questions, but just give you a sense of what our plans are moving forward and what the implementation will look like over the next several months. I think first and foremost, as we go into this, is really the philosophy behind what we're trying to achieve. And I think it's about education, it's about flexibility, it's about listening, and at the end of the day, it's about supporting an industry so licensees can be successful. So with that said, I'd like to just go through a couple of things, or a few things here. As far as the integration execution objectives, first of all, we needed to create an organizational structure to support this. And we've done that. So now we've integrated the marijuana program into the OLCC organization really to effectively leverage all the resources we currently have. We've done a remarkable job over the years licensing alcohol establishments. We know how to license people, so it just made a whole bunch of sense to leverage those resources as we move forward, and so we've done that. We developed an internal steering committee to support that effort. Our budget allowed us, I believe, 30 brand new employees to support the marijuana program. If you've been to our agency, we're pretty small and tight, so we really had to redesign the whole agency. It was a huge effort, so we had IT and finance, HR, and all the support divisions within the steering committee that we met on a weekly basis. We reported out. They reported back to their individual divisions, really to build a new culture at the OLCC to really support the overall marijuana program and get everybody included in the program. It's been effective. Probably the biggest thing is the integration of staff and internal training. I'll talk more about that later, and I'll talk more about the external training program. One of the major objectives of the program, as you know, are two support systems from an IT perspective to support the program, and I'm very happy to support that both are on track. First of all, our licensing system is scheduled to go based on statute. As you know, we need to start accepting applications January 4th. We are currently under user testing as we speak. So far, so good. I wasn't going to put this bullet in here, but I just did it because I figured it was going to be a question. We do have a paper process to back this up in case we should have any type of computer issues as we get to January 4th. We're really good with paper on the alcohol side, so it's not going to be a hard thing for us to transfer over to the marijuana side if we should need to do that. on the cannabis tracking system. We haven't begun yet. We'll begin user testing the first week of December. As you can see, if we have followed the stage gate process that was designed by the LFO and CIO's office, there's four stages. We're currently in stage three. But everything from that perspective is going forward on track, on budget, and on time. As far as the internal licensing and compliance training, I think this will be the key to our success. I talked a lot about, you know, our philosophy at the beginning. We'll maintain that. But you can see from the extensive list here, all of you have been in marijuana longer than I have, but all of us can collectively, thinking about all we've learned over the last 2 years, as we hire new staff, we've got a lot to educate them on in a very quick time frame. So it'll be a challenge, but if we put the right philosophies together, I'll think we'll be fine. But all the way from new employee orientation to the overview of Measure 91, HB 3400, our temporary rules, and on and on and on. We have to train them on the online application system. We got to train them on the cannabis tracking system. We want to put together best practices as far as compliance and investigations. And what I mean by that is I think it's really critical as we get out and talk to the industry about what our plans are, that we articulate exactly what the industry should expect from us. And then we should have plans in place so we actually enforce compliance and investigations consistently across the state. And we'll put a process in place to make sure that happens. Then the other thing we've already done, the industry's been great. We've already set up training programs with growers, processors, labs, and retail sites. So as our staff comes online and we begin our training process, we'll have exposure to the industry and be able to do some real-life testing in those environments.
Mr. Higlin, I'm sorry to jump in. In order to make sure that we have some time for questions, I wonder if you could give us kind of a top line of the internal processes and make sure we get to the timeline within the next, say, 5 minutes so that then we can ask any questions we have.
Not a problem.
Need a raise.
I think this is the most important part, and I'll fly through this after that. But we're, you know, to stay on course like we have with our transparency, your transparency through our temporary rulemaking process, is we're going out in December to do a roadshow around the state. This is to kind of let the air out of the balloon. We're not the big bad OLCC, but to actually bring the industry in, talk about what our philosophies are, train them on the rules, everything you've heard about today, but give them an idea of what the rules are, and then train them on the online system. Let them ask questions. We want it to come in. We want to be inclusive. And we're going to travel the state, like I said. We're going to start December 3rd in Bend. We'll be in Bend, Medford, Eugene, Salem, and I think we have a couple in Portland. You're all more invited or more than welcome to come. We'd love to have you. And that will be our first exposure to the industry. We can introduce our new marijuana staff and begin on the operational level. I'm trying to move a little bit faster.
And you had an unfortunate timing break on that. I think your really show is going to be really good.
The one thing I did want to point out, I think you have a copy of, is the readiness guide. I believe you just got the final copy. I still actually have a draft. You know, not everything that the licensees have to do are all going to be because of the OLC regulations, but there's going to be a lot of other regulations through state government. So through the direction of the governor's office or leadership through the governor's office, we put this together. We're pretty proud of it. We will take this out on the road with us. You can access this on our website, but it gives you a checklist of items to go through to give you a better shot at being successful as a retailer. And then if I may, I'll just go through the final timeline. Is our temporary rules are done. We've got some technical fixes that the chairman talked about. We have our training that we're going to hit the road here in December. We will actually back up the trainings when we're done with webinars if people for some reason couldn't attend or need more information. We'll start accepting applications on January 4th at 8:30 a.m. And then we'll go back out with the cannabis tracking system in the first quarter. We have the Oregon legislative session in February. Then we'll begin to issue licenses for growers, processors, labs in the second quarter is the plan right now. We'll have public hearings on our final rules. The commission will adopt the final rules in June. We plan on issuing our retail licenses in the third quarter, and then our retail stores will begin operating in the fourth quarter of 2016. With that, I'm here to answer any questions if you have them.
Senator Farioli, is that smile a question?
That is. Okay. A tell, I think that's called. I was just trying to work out the hourly rate of legislators, and it's not $15.
$15 now.
Wait for the lawsuit. Wait for it. Co-location. It's an issue we've dealt with in the interim, and it seems to be an obstacle as we come out of this process. In other words, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, panel, Madam Chair, is that OLCC has no enforcement or inspection authority on OHA or OMMP facilities, that currently we have retail sales ongoing in many of the OMMP facilities, but when the retail outlets open, these facilities are going to have to make a choice. They're going to either retain their role as an OMMP facility and have no retail, or they're going to go to retail and have no MMP connections. And I guess what I need to hear from the agency, not in this public meeting, because it's one I think you're going to have to think about, is a list of the obstacles that you perceive to having co-location. Because it seems to me a difficult proposition to stuff the genie back in the bottle and say, well, now that you've built a clientele and now that you have a business model that's successful, I've had no complaints from co-location so far. Now you're going to have to make a choice because you're a perceived threat somewhere. So I'd like to have a list of what your perceptions of the obstacles are. The other thing I'm concerned about is at the other end of this process, so much of the product that was provided to medical patients was a byproduct of the actual enterprise, which was not well disclosed, but pretty well understood by law enforcement. And people are going to have to make choices, and they're going to be economic choices. And we could, in fact, be in a situation where the 70, how many thousand OMMP cardholders, 74,000 cardholders, simply do not have access to the product that they've become dependent on for their medical needs. And so that, to me, mitigates for a more compassionate approach to co-location. So I want the list of the obstacles that you perceive so that we can demolish them in the 2016 legislative session. Thank you, Madam Chair. There was no question.
Well, thank you. Would you like to take that back to your offices and come up with that list, or would you like to take a first crack now? And then we have Representative Buckley after you finish.
Co-chair and members of the committee, I think we did try and address that to the legislative session and worked very hard on a co-location piece and tried to lay out for you, and we're happy to give you a list of those items related to concerns about co-location, about the rules and the legal obstacles related to co-location. We brought draft language to the committee and went and worked very diligently with industry for a co-location remedy to try and move this forward, and certainly a lot of it has to do with seed to sale tracking and what our perceived understanding of the Cole Memorandum was and a variety of other things, but we're happy to address that. And I guess I would ask the committee if they're interested in co-location. We certainly convened a group and worked very, very diligently. Your committee administrator attended, as well as staff and numerous legislators, some of those committee meetings to try and make sure that people could have access in a co-located environment. So, that's where I think we worked very diligently as an agency. So when you say that you wanted to destroy our arguments, we tried to make the argument before. We tried to forewarn this. So.
Is your comment on this, Tom?
Well, I would make a comment. I appreciate the Senator Farioli's comments, and I hope there's a willingness to re-enter these discussions. You know, this is a brand new world that we're trying to move into. We want to do it in the most effective way possible, both for primarily for the patients, but also for the small businesses in our communities. I had a question, Madam Co-Chair, about the residency issue. Thank you for your work on the residency issue. Thank you for trying to find that happy medium. And if you don't have the answer to this, I'll maybe can ask the industry panel if they have the answer to this. But during the conversations about residency, was there any data presented on Colorado's experience, for instance? Because there were statements made in our last meeting that by having a residency requirement, women and minority business people would be put at a disadvantage because they wouldn't have access to capital. I'm just wondering if there's any data to clarify that happened in Colorado, that there were a significant number of women operating businesses or minorities operating businesses that didn't get access to capital because of a residency requirement. So if you know if there's data, I'd love to get that answer.
I'm Co-Chair Representative Buckley. I don't recall through our deliberations of any data coming forward around that. There were certainly discussions about equity issues, but I don't recall any specific data points that I could remember from our discussions.
Thank you. Appreciate it. So if there's anybody from industry that wants to make the case about residency and has data to show that those claims are actually based on Colorado's experience or any other industry's experience, I'd love to know what that information is. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Great. Senator Cruz.
Something that occurred to me, and this may be a wild one, but we've been operating under the assumption that coal is the holy grail. It's an opinion and something that DOJ may or may not act on. I'm wondering if we should be looking at more flexibility under coal and what actually suits our needs, regardless of coal. Just a thought.
Well, you're bringing a whole bunch of new stuff to the table these days.
I'm trying to be more like Senator Pruzanski, so.
Good. It's a good strategy. You're getting applause from the back of the room, so there you go.
We've got a routine just watching.
Yeah, I'm watching you, too.
I think Representative Buckley made an important point, and you touched on it, and we've had some letters going back and forth on the residency requirement. I think as we've moved from the initial crafting of House Bill 3400 and the other measures in the long session to now, a number of us have had revised thoughts on what shape a residency requirement might make sense, whether it runs afoul of some constitutional requirements we have to not make it harder for people who don't live in Oregon to do business in Oregon than we're allowed to under the Privileges and Immunities Clause, and giving people fair access to capital. I think the industry panel and you folks, it'll be helpful to hear your perspectives on that. I think it's an issue that we're going to be talking about and trying to reach more of an angle of repose on in the short session, but exactly how that looks is something to be determined. Any other questions for this panel?
Madam Chair, just a clarification. I made a joke at Senator Pruzanski's expense to a degree. The reality is that November is Prostate Cancer Awareness Month, and as a prostate cancer survivor, that is the reason for this.
Is that right? Well, there you go.
Can we learn Senator Pruzanski's reason?
I just think something just happened here. I just missed.
That's the Smith brothers.
The first one didn't get me. The second one did.
I would say that there's only one birthday boy I'm aware of in this room. So you have, purview to say whatever you want to, Chair Patrick, the rest of us.
Here in the spirit of LCC, you're welcome to card him.
Yeah, that's right. Any other comments for this panel? I would like to then, Chair Patridge, say to you and to the team, I think that OLCC has done a really amazing job trying to run an inclusive process, evolve midway through. Hey, folks, if we could listen up, that'd be great. Try to evolve midway through. I like the outreach that you're doing to try to support youth prevention, even though you're not specifically called out in the statute as the agency that has responsibility for it. I think your commissioners have been tremendously receptive, and that's really important. I know that there's going to be some revised rules coming out that the commission is going to consider in the next few days. It sounds like community members have received copies of that. As of this morning, or it's going to be available?
I think that they're going out. They're really more technical fixes on what we're trying to do in four basic areas. And I think we've tried to communicate what those things are related to that. So, you know, the only thing that I would urge this panel to do is act early in February, because we don't want to slow the process down as best we can, right, especially on the residency requirement.
There is no lady.
But I know the realities of that.
Well, I think that's great. I think you've done a lot of great work, and we appreciate it. And have a great birthday. At least it's not 9 p.m. right now.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
It was touching to hear their expectation that we won't completely rewrite the thing in 2016.
It's touching to hear.
It's like touching.
All right. Oh, goodness.
Naive.
All right. So now we have panel three, industry folks. This may come as a surprise to you, but we need to, for a scheduling reason, have the local government update first. So thank you for your participation and your patience. And I'd like to now invite Mr. Rob Bovet of Association of Oregon Counties and Scott Winkles of the League of Oregon Cities to come forward for a presentation about your perspective on things that are happening. This is a hot time for opting out and decisions on marijuana legalization around the country, and we are pleased you could be here.
Sure.
Let's start with Mr. Sure. Bovet. We go alphabetical. You probably always are the loser in that, aren't you?
I get the last word.
You do. That's right. Thank you. Let's start with Mr. Bovet and then go to Mr. Winkles.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovet, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to update you on a couple of things. I thought I'd touch briefly on three topics here real quickly. First, a very brief update on what your 36 counties are up to with regard to various issues related to marijuana, retail, and medical in terms of businesses. I thought I'd talk a little bit about the six items I raised ever so briefly at your last meeting that I think you ought to consider fixing in 2016, and then get to something I didn't have time to talk about, which is the status of marijuana business litigation in Colorado, Washington, and Oregon, just to give you an update on where things stand today and maybe some insights on where things are heading, at least as far as I can tell. So first, a status of local control of marijuana businesses. As you know, we have a clarification in House Bill 3400 of a number of things, time, place, and manner, two opt-out paths as well. This is how the counties charted out in terms of opt-out path one, who said no and who said hell no, for lack of a better term. The hell no counties being in red, the no counties being in orange that are less than 55%, and the yes counties being in green. As of today, this is how it looks in terms of counties. Now, I have to give you my disclaimer, which is for those, mostly for those in the audience, county ordinances, as a general matter, don't apply inside cities. So what we're talking about on this map is unincorporated areas. He can talk about the cities. I don't track them. This is counties, unincorporated areas. So the ones in red have exercised their opt-out option under House Bill 3400 without an election. The ones in orange have essentially put it all out to a vote next November regarding marijuana businesses. The ones in green are working on time, place, and manner ordinances. The counties in blue are basically likely to adopt and take no action, essentially defaulting to the state rules with no supplemental time, place, and manner. And the yellow ones are all in the process of deciding which direction to head. Now, I could take an educated guess about most of those. I suspect you can too, although I suspect a couple of the eastern Oregon counties you might be surprised about. But I'll leave that for a later time. Legislative tune-ups needed in 2016, I ran through them in 30 seconds. The six things I think you need to fix, I'll spend maybe a little more time here today. First, and I have actually crafted for you some legislation to consider. It's in your packet or online for OLIS for everyone to read. The first thing I'll put a bug in your ear about is the distribution formula for state taxes. We didn't tinker with that in House Bill 3400. As you may recall, there are two phases to distribution. Until July 1st of 2017, it's based on population. I believe that little to no dollars are going to actually be distributed because OLCC is going to primarily be repaying the money they've borrowed from the alcohol fund. What we're really talking about is tax distributions post July 1st of 2017 and how these get distributed. I believe that the formula in Measure 91 will fail to get the money dispersed to where we, and you, I believe, need it dispersed most to deal with enforcement issues, particularly at a local level. I have come up with draft language that I think would better allocate those dollars to where they're needed most for enforcement purposes. But I have a big note here, and there's a big note in what I've crafted, which is this is just my idea. It may be terrible. You may have a better one. What I know you need to do, preferably in 2016, but actually you can wait till 2017 because this really doesn't affect anything until July 1st of 2017, is tinker with the formula. Make it work to ensure that those who need the enforcement dollars get the enforcement dollars, because I'm 100% convinced if we don't tinker with the formula, we won't accomplish that goal. I would urge you to do it again in 2016 because I think it's better that we incentivize more opt-ins, which I'll explain in a minute, but it can wait till 2017. The taxation forfeiture provision, I think after we get past the December deadline on Section 133, which is the opt-out without an election, we ought to rethink the taxation forfeiture provisions and build in things to incentivize opt-ins. One of the things I've heard from some of our members are things like this. Well, gosh, we might very well have allowed for production or for processing if they hadn't precluded all tax revenues for all categories of businesses. And so what I'm telling you is that maybe post-December we have a reverse incentive going on here. We have a disincentive to opt back in, and I think you ought to build in an incentive. And I've crafted language in Section 1 at the end of it that would allow for those that opt in select to selective marijuana businesses to share in just those selective portions of the tax revenue and build in an incentive, especially to some rural Oregon counties and some eastern Oregon counties, opting back in to certain things such as growing. In terms of opting back in, I have also crafted a Section 2 that I have before you. And let me explain this. I believe, and it's my legal opinion for what it's worth, that a county that opts out of any category of marijuana businesses may simply repeal the opt-out and thus opt in. However, there are legal arguments arguably to the contrary, and I don't want any of my members subjected to litigation or the threat of litigation and the disincentive to opt back in. So I think you ought to enact a simple provision, and Section 2 is a simple provision that just clarifies you can opt back in to any of the classes of businesses to take it out of potential litigation. Number four, this is a big one. This is something that Representative Olson and Senator Prezansky and Representative Leininger and I got, I would say, maybe halfway done with in 3400, restructuring a lot of the marijuana offenses. This takes up the bulk of what I've crafted for you. It's pages 5 to 12 of the draft legislation, and I've done a section-by-section explanation for you. I'll just hit on a couple of the highlight areas and let you ask questions if you want more. Section 6 of Measure 91 provides for, and still provides for, the personal allowance exemptions allowed for recreational marijuana. The way it was crafted, I think, needs to be adjusted. By way of example, it refers to, in most of its paragraphs, homemade and home-produced marijuana, and those operate as limitations on the exemption. So let me give you a real-world example. If a person goes and buys retail marijuana today from a medical marijuana dispensary, takes it home and shares it with their spouse, the way the law is technically written right now, they've committed the offense of delivery of a controlled substance. I think we need to fix that. That's not the intent, clearly, of Section 6. And what I've crafted in, I believe it's Section 3 of the bill, would fix pieces of that. The other thing that we just didn't have time to get to are manufacture and delivery of and possession of controlled substance, marijuana, within 1,000 feet of a school. It remains for delivery and manufacture a Class A felony as a baseline, and there's just a big jump. If you're 999 feet away from a school, You get an A felony. If you're 1,001 feet away from a school, you get a B misdemeanor. There's just too big of a jump, or an A misdemeanor, depending on how it comes out. So what I've crafted for you in the bill for all of those provisions is basically a reduction of the baseline from an A felony to a C felony with some carve-outs, most notably a carve-out to retain a higher-level offense for the manufacture of marijuana extracts, which, of course, poses the public health and safety risk that we all talked about. So I have sections for you to look at with regard to that as well. So I'd encourage you to look at the revisions of the criminal statutes that I've provided. I think it goes along with the conversations that Representative Olson and I and Senator Prezansky and I had at the end of the session, the things we were essentially unable to get to. I'm trying to get to the rest of them. The fifth thing I'll mention is already been mentioned. We need to clean up the 305 statute that allows local governments to enter into intergovernmental agreements to have the Department of Revenue collect local sales taxes. The Department of Justice has interpreted that to not apply to marijuana tax because it's a special sales tax, not a general sales tax. So we need to do a surgical amendment to 305-620 to make it easier. I can't imagine anybody objecting to this. It makes sense to just have one tax collecting authority and do intergovernmental agreements. We've already started the work on these intergovernmental agreements, but kind of came to a screeching halt when we realized 305-620 actually didn't cover us. And OLCC's mentioned this already. OLCC's also mentioned the Lux language, so I would propose to insert two words to accomplish the goal of clarifying that applicants can, in fact, ask for the Lux and are encouraged to submit the Lux with their application so OLCC doesn't have to do it for them. So that's my legislative tune-ups for you in 2016. I encourage you to seriously consider all six of those, and maybe with the possible exception of number one, I would strongly encourage you to enact them. Status of litigation, something I wasn't able to get to, and I'll race through this here real quickly as well. First off, in Oregon, a lot of questions a lot of folks have about the Cave Junction cases. These are the lead cases in the state of Oregon. Cave Junction 1, Cave Junction 2, they are two separate cases filed under two separate statutes, but they both involve functionally the same two questions. First, does state law preempt any other opt-out paths beyond what's provided specifically in Oregon statute? In other words, is there preemption of alternate paths to opt out of marijuana businesses? And if the answer to that question is yes, does federal law trump? These are issues we've talked about, well, I've talked about ad nauseum for a couple of years now. I should note that AOC, and I think I speak for LOC as well, we continue to be agnostic on marijuana. We're here to defend local control and local rights, of course. The results of Cave Junction 1 and Cave Junction 2 in the trial courts is kind of interesting. We appear before two different circuit court judges. The two different circuit court judges answered these questions differently, even though they're in the same circuit. The first judge basically said there's no state preemption. He didn't answer the federal question. He said there's no state preemption, so alternate paths are allowed. The second judge skipped past the state question and answered the federal question. He said it doesn't matter if there's state preemption, federal law trumps. So we have two compatible decisions based on different grounds. Both of them have been appealed to the Court of Appeals. Cave Junction 1 has been fully briefed. Cave Junction 2 is in the process of briefing. Folks have asked me, well, isn't this moot? Aren't most local governments going to choose one of the paths provided by 3400? I think that's probably true, but there are some exceptions and outliers, and these questions still appear to be live. In terms of the state of Washington, I-502 was silent on local authority. Washington has a different home rule law than we do, with different case law. The Washington Attorney General has been steadfastly defending local rights to opt out and is saying that I-502 does not preempt local opt out of marijuana businesses. And so far, every superior court in Washington that's heard that issue has agreed with the Washington Attorney General on that issue. The lead case is from the city of Fife. It's currently at the Washington Court of Appeals. Briefing is now complete, and I don't think oral argument's been scheduled. Colorado, a lot of interesting things going on that you probably ought to know about that I think are kind of instructive. First, the one that got probably the most media attention is Nebraska and Oklahoma suing Colorado to basically get a federal injunction from the U.S. Supreme Court shutting down the Colorado marijuana business licensing scheme. When a state sues another state, original jurisdiction is in the U.S. Supreme Court.
But interestingly enough, the Supreme Court doesn't have to take the case. So the Supreme Court is in the process of deciding whether or not to even take the case. Nine former DEA administrators, probably to no surprise, have encouraged the Supreme Court to take the case and side with Nebraska and Oklahoma. Colorado, Washington, and Oregon are basically saying, no Supreme Court, stay out of this. Let the state experimentation continue on. And basically the Supreme Court has asked the United States Department of Justice to chime in. And that was the last thing that's occurred in the case, and so far the Obama administration hasn't chimed in as to whether the U.S. Supreme Court ought to take on the case. My guess, pure speculation, is the U.S. Supreme Court's not going to take this case. But it's interesting. That's been the high, that's been the above-the-fold headlines of Colorado. Probably more interesting, or potentially more interesting as a practical matter, are the Supremacy Clause preemption cases, and there are two categories of these. A number of sheriffs, both from within Colorado and outside of Colorado, have sued the state of Colorado seeking a federal court injunction shutting down the business licensing provisions of the Colorado Initiative. I'm not sure where this one will spin out. You can see it's fairly early on in the litigation. It was just filed March 5th of this year, and there have been, are motions to clarify, dismiss, and a variety. They're in motion practice right now. Also interesting are the RICO cases, and this is what I kind of wanted to really talk to you about last time, didn't have quite the opportunity, and why I think this is important for our members to understand, and I think it's important for the industry to understand in terms of where we cite marijuana businesses. And there are a couple of reasons why we have to be real careful here. So in 1970, Congress enacted the Racketeer Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act, RICO. It was designed to attack organized crime. And what it basically says is if you or some entity or your partners or your conspirators, however you want to look at it, engage in a series of what are called predicate acts, in other words, violations of federal law, usually criminal law, then you can be charged criminally under RICO. It's really designed to get at organized crime. There are forfeiture provisions as well, so people forfeit what are deemed ill-gotten gains under RICO. Little known, fairly little used, is civil RICO. RICO had a provision in it that basically says this, and I'm oversimplifying for purposes of time, so give me this here. If you are a person or a business who can prove that you have been economically damaged by someone else's RICO activity, you can sue them for treble damages, three times the amount of your economic damages, and attorney's fees. A pretty heavy stick. So what's happened in Colorado in a couple of cases is these cases have been filed. And I'll just mention a couple of them. Riley, this was filed by, and it's still in the beginning stages, this was filed both under RICO and preemption. This is an owner of 105 acres of land in Wright, Colorado, who's alleging that they have been economically harmed by diminution in their property value by having a retail marijuana grow facility licensed by the state of Colorado next door. And under RICO, you don't just sue the person who is engaged in that business that you are alleging has caused you economic damage. You sue everybody. You sue their bank. You sue their bonding company. You sue everybody who's done anything. They've also joined in the governor and state officials as well as the county arguing preemption of the state and local licensing. Again, this one is in fairly early on stages of discovery and motion practice, just filed here earlier this year. This one spun out a little differently. New Vision Hotels versus Medical Marijuana of the Rockies. The owner of a Holiday Inn, which is basically on the lower picture on the right-hand side, the large building there, sued the owners of Summit Marijuana, who had planned to open a retail and medical marijuana shop on the building just to the left of that big building across the parking lot, alleging that they had been economically harmed, but because by the operation of this marijuana business, a number of their clients who had specifically used this hotel for particularly skiing, the Boy Scouts, etc., and they could they've at least alleged pretty substantial economic damage as a result of being located near a retail marijuana dispensary. So they sued again, everybody under RICO. The way this case spun out is for this particular marijuana business owner, he had to essentially close down, not because he lost the case, but because all his business partners fled, and they fled quickly. So the bank fled, the bonding company fled, the property owner, the landlord fled, everybody fled, and he wound up having to close down as a result of the filing of the suit. Why I think this is instructive for counties and cities and for you all is that I think it's, and for the industry, it's important that we carefully cite marijuana businesses at this current time, because it seems to me foolish to hand a neighbor a cause of action. And I think we just need to be put that in our mind, as well as all the other things we think about, you know, siting within 1,000 feet of a school, all these other things we think about. We need to probably think about that in the mix of everything else, because handing someone a federal cause of action for treble damages and attorney's fees probably isn't a wise thing to do. So that concludes my presentation for you here, and I'll turn it over to Scott.
Great. Thank you so much.
Welcome. For the record, Scott Wingles, representing the League of Oregon Cities. I can I can go through what's going on in city land. I can say it's the situation still remains somewhat fluid, although I think it is calming down a little bit right now, and as cities sort of figure out which direction they want to go. First off, as of this morning, the most recent list I could find is that 24 cities have either enacted a ban or a or have referred a ban to the voters. I expect that number to increase as cities that aren't on the list have contacted me with questions and as to timing and whatnot. The way we've calculated 180 days from the sign from the enactment of House Bill 3400 is roughly Christmas Eve, if you count in the weekend and the holiday. I don't think anybody planned it that way, that's when a city would have to enact to in order if they wish to put a moratorium or a ban in on a medical facility. So I think through this month and probably in the first 2 weeks of December, we'll get a better count as to how many cities will actually be moving forward with a ban or a referral to a ban. I would also like to compliment the OHA and the OLCC for how they've conducted the rules and the processes. Particularly, I think we've seen a sort of change in attitude at OHA in terms to medical marijuana, where I think we're seeing some more aggressive protection of public and patients as well. The rules to us look pretty good. I think some of the recommendations coming out of the subs, particularly in the OLCC process, are initially were concerning to us, but I think what was adopted and what the commission enacted does protect the public and allow these businesses to move forward. There was a comment made earlier that most dispensaries seem to be conducting themselves well. I think from hearing from my members, most dispensaries really are obeying the rules, but the misconduct that we've seen has been significant in those minority members. I think we've seen there was a dispensary in Portland distributing edibles, allowing edibles to be distributed and extracts in their parking lot without IDs being checked. It was documented instances of marijuana leaving the door of a facility without being logged, IDs not being checked. Those are concerning to cities, and I think cities will, as they're enacting their ordinances, are going to be looking at a robust regulatory structure that the Cole memo does require. Additionally, we're still seeing some products on the market that are obviously enticing to minors. There's we found one. A marijuana candy shaped like a robot that clearly is outside the scope of what's allowed. And I think my understanding is when the business was contacted about this particular item, their solution was to put more sugar on the piece to obscure its shape. And I don't think that was the sort of answer that anybody was looking for. Additionally, I've personally seen I believe it's called a squib in a circular container. It's childproof. It's a brightly colored jelly type candy. Its childproof packaging is a sticker, and that's I don't think that's what the legislature was envisioning when it required child-safe packaging for these products. And so ensuring that these items are in compliance with what the legislature required is going to be paramount in ensuring cities are going to be comfortable moving forward and making sure they have confidence in a robust regulatory structure. One area that I think would be of interest to the committee is that I'm personally working on a draft ordinance that would fold the administrative rules from the OLCC and the OHA allow them to adopt them as a county code as well. And so the purpose for doing so is that a county code enforcement officer, a city manager, a police officer could enforce the same rules, and that would actually increase the amount of enforcement moving forward. And so if an item isn't in a child safe packaging, that's something that the city could act on. They wouldn't simply have to go to the agency and file a complaint and go through that process. They could issue a citation and it would go to muni court, which would be appealable, a municipal court, which appealable to circuit, or if it's a court of record, appealable to the appellate. And that's one area where I think we're exploring, and we think that has some potential to increase the oversight of the agency. I also agree that we do need to change the way the land use compatibility statements are issued. The current system, I think the way it's working out, is somewhat inelegant and inefficient. I think having the agency go to the city to get the LUX is adding time and cost and inefficiencies, where simply having the applicant request it and submit it as part of their application makes tremendous more sense and would be better for all parties involved. Additionally, changing the statute to allow city to enter into a intergovernmental agreement with the Department of Revenue so that there could be one point of tax collection. Right now, a city could impose a tax, but as we're all aware, we'd all like to see change. These are largely cash-only businesses, and so I don't think it works for the business, the local government, or the local government to have two separate tax collection agencies. I think it's more efficient for everybody if it was one point. I've seen some of the written testimony that has been submitted, and there are some concerns about things that cities may have discussed at some point, or a city councilor or a planning commissioner may have brought up. And I think there's a testimony that it's a planning commissioner suggested in a planning commission meeting that it'd be unlawful to have children in the same room where marijuana is growing. I think I bring up Reedsport particularly because one of their city councilors actually approached me and inquired as to whether or not the city could open their own retail shop. And what these two instances have in common is that neither of them are going to happen. Cities are discussing things. They're vetting them. Their people are thinking out loud. I think these issues are going to settle down. I think somebody in St. Helens did propose a tax on edibles or on infused products. They didn't do it. I mean, they didn't put pen to paper and enact an ordinance. And I think there's a huge difference between someone asking a question or suggesting something in the course of a meeting and actually going through a first, a second reading and adopting an ordinance that would actually be binding. So I think a lot of these issues are going to settle down as we get closer to the enactment date. But with that, I'm happy and eager for your questions. And I do appreciate you accommodating my schedule so I could go testify where all the shouting is.
We're so sorry to hold you back from that.
Pretty upset.
Questions for the panel? I think I saw Senator Prozanski's hand first, and then Representative Olson, Representative Helm.
Scott, thank you for bringing this up, especially the last part, because I've heard from numerous people that there's been one or two cities that have either adopted or actually are in the process of a tax for medical marijuana. So can you tell us today whether anyone that you know of, any of the cities have or haven't either implemented or in the process?
Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Senator Prozanski, I am not personally aware of any city that has enacted a medical tax. I have been asked about it. When I asked, I say I think that they're on very shaky ground. I don't think it's defensible. I know that there is a city attorney, and I'm not even sure I remember all of his clients, who has developed a theory that they could. I think when they've asked us, we've told them we think doing so would be very problematic and probably not, and probably wouldn't work.
All right. Same question, Rob. Any counties in that situation?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Brzezinski, there was one county, Jackson County, that had its voters authorized taxation of medical marijuana prior to, actually, I think it was concurrent or just after Measure 91, prior to House Bill 3400. It's my understanding that Jackson County actually repealed that ordinance and never imposed the tax. So to my knowledge, none of the 36 counties have a tax on the books related to medical marijuana.
Thank you. Could I just ask staff? Adam, I had sent something to you regarding an LC opinion. Did that get distributed?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I don't know that it has, but we'll make sure it's done by the end of today.
Co-Chair Langer,
I'd like to grow a beard.
You're going to have to do that.
If I could, I'd like to caveat that statement. I say I'm not personally aware. If they haven't talked to me and they haven't called us, they haven't notified the league, I don't know. So I'm not saying there isn't somebody who hasn't, but I'm telling you, but based on my knowledge as of today, I don't know of anybody who has imposed any city that has imposed a medical marijuana tax.
And Madam Co-Chair, if I could just add as well, what Scott said that referred to League of Oregon Cities advice to cities that have asked is essentially the same advice that I'm dispensing to counties that have asked. I think there is a theory out there that preemption doesn't apply in a certain very narrow specific way, and I'm not convinced the theory holds any water.
Okay.
So, Madam Co-Chair, the only thing I'll say is that for those here, that opinion will be up. It is an LC opinion regarding whether local governments has the authority to tax medical marijuana, which they say emphatically they do not.
Do not. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Representative Olson and then Representative Helm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rob, we had some discussion last week regarding the restructuring of the sentencing, and you were going to float that by some law enforcement agencies. Any response back?
Co-Chair and Representative Olson, yes, there seems to be a general consensus that we're heading down the right path. Everybody seems to agree that we need to continue the cleanup process, even if it involves reductions in various things that we've talked about. One of the gaps that was pointed out to me, I forgot to mention before, was the open container statute. Here in Oregon, we have an open container about related to alcohol. We failed to do one related to marijuana. The Colorado and Washington measures both failed to do one relating to marijuana, and both legislatures have enacted those to fill in that gap. So the only comments I got back were, we really need to fill that gap here. We need it now. And so I crafted that as part of the provisions. I forgot to mention that before.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to note, Representative Olson, Senator Brzezinski, the two of you have done some really great work, and I really appreciate, Representative Olson, you drawing on your expertise with law enforcement to try to find a path forward that makes sense from all perspectives. So, way to go.
Thank you.
And of course, Mr. Bovet, too. Representative Helm.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This is for Scott, and I appreciate you being here today, Scott. The local code enforcement ordinance that you talked about, where there's a consideration of giving local enforcement capability for code enforcement officers or law enforcement to enforce OHA and OLCC rules. If I'm understanding that right, it would be sort of a parallel authority to what the state has. Would those law enforcement or code enforcement individuals be given the same OLCC or OHA agent training so that they are, so those local jurisdictions are sure that we have parallel and consistent enforcement of the same law?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Helm, I don't know that I've gotten that far yet. It isn't unheard of that a city would adopt into its local code a state statute. I mean, several cities have adopted the traffic code into their local codes. So you're writing a local ordinance violation as opposed to a state violation. So this isn't necessarily earth-shattering or breaking new ground. that we would do that. And I think the standard would be a plain language standard. I think we would converse and coordinate with the agency if a city chose to do so. But like I said, this is almost, I don't want to say typical, but it's fairly common that the city would adopt a state code into, or a state statute or a state AOR into their code. So,
thank you.
Yes, please.
Follow up. And I think when that works well, it works really, really well. And if it doesn't work well, it puts the dispensary owner or the grower or the producer in a bind between two regulatory agencies that may be telling them different things. And I would really hate to see that. That's why I was curious about the cross-training. So that might be a conversation as we go forward to make sure that those systems work well together.
Co-Chair Leininger, Representative Helm, I would also point out that if a city were to issue a violation, it would actually be a violation or an unclassified misdemeanor. And so the standard of proof would actually be higher that way as well, as opposed to through an administrative hearing.
But you can see that in your edibles example, for example, in the future when edibles become available, if you have a state agent coming in and looking around and saying, I don't see a problem, and then your code enforcement agent coming in and saying, well, that one, I think that one's attractive to a minor, those are two levels of different enforcement on the same thing that are incompatible. And I would really hate to see that.
Just give them a little star and have a stick in the window.
Have them call representative.
So, Senator Farrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This county map proves orange is the new black. So it's just like only half the state has opted out. And I think those cities are predictable in those areas. But I think it's safe to say that a number of my constituents are pretty chapped about the opt-out. And I had some discussions with people who were concerned about the opt-out, particularly for medical dispensaries. And I wanted to assure them that nothing that the city or the county did, and certainly nothing that the legislature has done, prevents them from referring the question to voters. So there was at least some confusion, Madam Chair, about whether or not the language in Chapter 614, which is the ORS version of House Bill 3400, precluded any rights that they have under the Oregon Constitution. So I asked the question of legal counsel, and the answer is an emphatic no. Nothing in the enactment of 3400 or in the subsequent Oregon revised statutes would preclude citizens from exercising their right to an initiative petition, like to give the opinion to the committee, 20 copies. It's up on all this today. I just wanted to clarify that Oregonians who want to seek redress of activity still have every right under the initiative that they had before we enacted 3400. So just, I promised I'd get them an answer. They have the answer. Now it's published publicly. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you very much. And a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Scott, a question for you. Down in Josephine County, we have a number of incensed property owners. They've just gone through their first harvest season next to grows. In many cases, they're surrounded on at least three sides. And I've gotten the question a number of times, you know, how could you guys have done this? And, you know, the explanation is what it is. My question is, do you ever see any fix or any change related to where on a person's property their grows are located? It's particularly offensive to a number of my constituents who have noted grows right next to a property line, not located in a central spot on the property, but right on the property line that may in some cases be 50 to 75 yards away from someone's backyard, deck, their social center of their property. First of all, have you had any experience with this? Have you heard much of this? And if so, do you ever see any kind of meaningful alteration happen that can mitigate that circumstance?
Madam Co-Chairs, Representative Wilson, odor is by far the most common complaint that a city government will receive in regards to marijuana. Typically, the way I don't know that it would be, I foresee a marijuana-specific change to that, because typically the way an offensive odor ordinance works is that if the odor is offensive and it's detectable at the property line, then the owner must mitigate. And so it wouldn't matter if it's it can actually be pungent cooking that would trigger this, or animal waste, or marijuana. Regardless of where it comes from, I think the owner would be required to find a way to mitigate. My understanding is planting hops seems to help, but I don't have any personal experience with it. But.
Yeah, thanks.
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Wilson, if I could add from a county perspective, the exception to what Scott just said, which is largely irrelevant to cities, is EFU, exclusive farm use areas. And we made the growing of retail marijuana and EFUs of farm use. So smells associated with farm use would be a nuisance odors, and those would be protected by the Right to Farm Act. So that would be different.
Yeah. Wasn't there a Court of Appeals decision on the actionability of odor from marijuana grow sites? I'm seeing Chair Patridge nod his head. I don't remember what the holding was, but it was something like it's not actionable. Maybe it was on EFU land, and so it wasn't. Do you recall?
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair, if it's on EFU lands, it's non-actionable. And if it's on other rural residential properties that counties essentially treat the same as EFU for purposes of this, it wouldn't be actionable, arguably, under the Right to Farm Act. People would be essentially precluded from suing.
Senator Cruz, and then I think we're going to try to transition to our
okay.
next panel.
Just a slight bit of confusion. I'm somewhat familiar with Right to Farm. And basically what it is designed for is, okay, I have a pig farm, and people move in next to me and say, and then they complain about the pig farm. Okay, they don't have the right to do that. But if there's residential areas, and then I decide to move a pig farm in, they do have a right. So there is a balancing act here. If there is a residential area, regardless of how it's zoned, and somebody wanted to come in, I think there is a potential cause of action there.
And Madam Co-Chair, I would agree. It really depends on where you're located.
I wanted to ask your opinion before we transition on some of the decisions that city councils are considering about not allowing marijuana grows. And I know, and I've gotten some questions from people about the Medford City Council considering, but it's only done a first reading, an ordinance around prohibiting marijuana grows within the city limits. And the question I have for you is, I'm hoping you can confirm that your legal understanding is what our legislative intent was, namely the ability to opt out does not extend to the 4-plant per person allocation or to medical grows for a patient by a caregiver. So even if the city were to move forward with that ordinance, its capacity of things to opt out of is not the whole universe, actually, of marijuana production in the city limits.
I would say with Madam Co-Chair, Medford is complicated in that there's a circuit court ruling in regards to the question of federal preemption that the city prevailed in, and so I'm reticent as not, I'm not an attorney, so I'm reticent to offer a legal opinion as to whether or not that would hold. But I know that Medford has prevailed twice on the federal preemption question, and so the holdings in that county may be different. If you asked me about another county where this had not been litigated, I'd probably agree with you, but Medford complicates things.
Do you want to weigh in?
Madam Co-Chair, I don't track cities, of course, but fundamentally the personal allowance provisions of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act and Measure 91 operate differently than the licensure of businesses. Personal allowance provisions operate as exemptions from state criminal law. So I can grow 4 marijuana plants in my apartment and be my good friend, Walt Beglaw, the Marion County District Attorney, cannot prosecute me for that. Now, my landlord, Tony, will evict me, but that's a different matter, right? So I get an exemption from state criminal law. The general black letter law in Oregon is a county or a city cannot recriminalize what you, the legislature, have decriminalized. So fundamentally, those are two different issues. The personal allowance provisions operate independently of any state licensure of business. And so I don't know what the Medford cases involve. I don't know really what the Medford City Council is looking at, but I would be loath to recommend or even suggest that any of my members could opt out of the personal allowance growing offered under the Medical Marijuana Act or Measure 91. I don't think that's legally survivable.
Okay. And then I see Representative Buckley, maybe you have our final question for this panel.
Well, just a quick comment. I would stipulate that Medford is complicated. I'd also just want to note for the committee, there have been 27 complaints in Medford, City of Medford. 22 of those complaints have been mitigated successfully. So it has not been an overwhelming problem, and I hope that they can work it out. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Thank you to the panel. We sure appreciate it. And I will invite up now our panel of community members speaking from various industry and community perspectives. We have Nikki Terzieff from the Oregon Cannabis Business Council, Noah Stokes from CannaGuard Security, Leah Maurer from Women Grow Portland, and Sam Chapman from New Economy Consulting. Thank you. Please join us at the front. It looks like we may need one more chair. Apologize for that.
Surprising at all.
But we will take care of that. In fact, you get the birthday chair, which maybe carries special prerogatives. I don't know. You can test it. So you can decide. Thank you so much for taking time to come talk to us as you try to run your businesses and have your lives outside of the legislature. Please, if you could decide in what order you want to proceed, if one of you needs to get rolling. So let's start with Ms. Maurer. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Absolutely.
And we're hoping folks can speak for, say, no more than 5 minutes, so we have a few minutes for questions. Then we have one more panel still before the end of
okay. Try to be concise.
Thank you.
My name is Leah Maurer. Thank you so much for having me here today. I'm an activist and a professional here in the Oregon cannabis industry. I co-founded New Approach Oregon, founded a group called Moms for Yes on Measure 91 during the Measure 91 campaign, and I now serve as the co-chair for the Portland Women Grow chapter, where we have grown to be the largest cannabis industry networking organization in the state. Additionally, I have a degree in early childhood education, and I taught public school for several years before having my own children. I have 3 boys that are 10, 8, and almost 4 years old. I regularly volunteer at their school, and I am the co-president of the PTA there. So as you can see, I'm immersed in the world of not just being a mother, but also this emerging cannabis industry we have here in Oregon. My top priority is the safety of my children, and this is a huge reason why I was such a big supporter of Measure 91 and why I continue to watch very closely how both the law and the industry are rolling out and stay as involved as possible. Today I'm going to touch briefly on the industry as a professional and someone who has a lot of insight in that area, but mostly I'll be speaking from my perspective as a parent. But I want you all to know that whether I am wearing the hat of an activist, a professional, or a mother, that my biggest goal is to help that ensure our laws, industry, and regulations in the area of cannabis are a model for the rest of the country, just as we in Oregon have been in so many other areas. I truly believe that Oregon has the chance yet again to be a leader in the United States and really set the standard high for every other state that chooses to put this type of legislation in place. A lot of what I'm going to focus on today is prevention. I think that it was refreshing to hear that there's already some work being done on prevention, but I really believe that the OHA, the OLCC, and the legislature need to shape clear actions and address prevention, and it's urgent to launch this as soon as you can. We have to recognize that strong prevention measures must be in place as we roll this law out. We need to ensure that it is clear that marijuana is not safe for children, and this needs to be a priority. I realize that in House Bill 3400, there have been some answers to prevention in terms of packaging and marketing, and I think this is great, and I'm confident that rulemakers will do a good job in this area, but I think we need to do more. We need drug education that is scientifically grounded, not an angle that marijuana ruins everything. In states where we have scientifically based and objectively communicated tobacco education, teen use of tobacco products has gone down. As we give our youth factual and objective sex education as well, in doing so, we have seen a drop in teen pregnancy rates, and we need to do the same thing with marijuana. Currently, drug education is either non-existent or so unrealistic that many teachers are uncomfortable teaching it. We're simply ignoring the fact that we could be hugely proactive in terms of prevention because so much out there is the just say no mentality still, which is not realistic or effective. By not teaching our youth about marijuana and other substances with a factual, scientific-based method, we are doing a huge, huge disservice to them. We need a better approach. I believe there's also language in 3400 about developing a drug education curriculum, and we need a curriculum that is founded on valid research and for it to be taught in a sound way and ensure that young people are educated about their bodies and brains in regards to marijuana and what it can do to you. I spoke with Richard Harris, who I think many of you know is the former head of mental health and addiction services for the state, and he told me that currently there are no state funds being put towards this, that it is only federal pass-through money that is working on this. And I feel that we really need to be spending as much on prevention and education as we are on punishing people. So this legislature could be the first in the state to ever do that. So I would encourage you to really think about that. By being proactive rather than reactive, we will save lots of tax money in the long run. Another thing in terms of prevention and really just overall, I think that we really need to consider here is that there's a huge need for a yardstick to measure the success of the effectiveness of legalization. Not one group saying yes and not one group saying no, but actual validated data about what is going on in Oregon since the passage of the measure and rolling out of this new industry. We need to create a tool to measure whether or not our new rules and policies are working for a variety of reasons. But from my perspective, there are two main reasons for this. One, to evaluate and possibly adjust our policies, we need to see whether or not they work. Otherwise, we're just guessing. Number two, other states looking to legalize will want to know how it's working, and we have an opportunity to lead the rest of the country on crafting and measuring good policies. We don't want to debate in this area, and we need to know for certain what the effectiveness is in areas such as what is the number of incarcerations for marijuana now? Is the amount of money what is the amount of money going into the legal rather than the criminal market? Is there more or less marijuana in the hands of kids? What's the rate of usage among youth here? Has it declined since legalization? How much tax revenue is coming in, and what are some good things happening with it? So those are just a few starting points, but because there's plenty more. But as both a parent and an industry professional, there's a huge need for a tool from both the OLCC and the legislature to measure the success of this law. The bottom line is that we need a solid measurement, and we need valid data and a valid way to measure it. Other than that, things that I think that we can do about that we can do now when we're thinking about in terms of prevention, I'm going to talk about a few, both from my perspective as a parent and my perspective as a professional with a great deal of insight into the Oregon cannabis industry. I'm concerned about local and statewide policies that are rooted in the old drug war mentality and only serve to help criminals. We need to modernize our thinking on drug policy and look to what has been successful elsewhere. Here are a few examples of policies I believe only encourage criminal behavior. Residency requirements. Residency requirements will only encourage people to hide where the money is coming from to start and run their otherwise legitimate and respectable businesses. If residency requirements are not overturned, this is simply an area of the black market that will continue to operate as people try to hide this. It's unrealistic to think businesses won't seek investors. This policy only encourages people to be duplicitous. Bans, like we've already talked about. Strict bans of adult use cannabis sales in counties will also encourage the black market to continue to operate. Counties should not be able to opt out in this way, as it will only slow and discourage the progress we are seeing elsewhere in the state with regulated sales. By allowing strict bans, You are only encouraging people to buy marijuana in one place and sell it for more money in places where it's illegal. As a parent, this is hugely concerning for me because one of the main reasons I was such an advocate for Measure 91 was to drive the black market out of existence. Strict bans will only allow the black market to thrive and thus allow youth to get marijuana easily. This defeats the purpose of a regulated system and will work against all the other prevention measures that we put in place.
So if you could wrap up in about the next
one more thing,
that'd be excellent.
Finally, last thing, delivery. Delivery is a big deal for the criminal market. Illegal dealers have been delivering marijuana for decades. Simply making delivery illegal isn't going to work. People will deliver it anyways, as they were when penalties were much stiffer, and they will do it in a way that puts children in danger. This is unacceptable. The way to deal with delivery is to strictly regulate it. This is exactly what voters have asked for with marijuana, and we've already seen that it works. People stuck in a drug war mentality often confuse control with prohibition. Prohibition is the worst way to control something. Regulation is the way to have better control over this part of the market. I foresee delivery as being one of the biggest vulnerabilities in this system, and we need to address it by keeping delivery regulated, not pushing business over to the black market criminals who are already well established in this sector of the market. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Great job. Mr. Chapman, welcome. Or are we going to Ms. Terzieff? No, we're going to Mr. Chapman.
All right. Are you clicking?
I'll push buttons for you.
Are you sure?
Yep.
Team player over here.
That's right.
Co-chairs, committee members, for the record, my name is Sam Chapman. I'm founder of New Economy Consulting. One of the areas in which our firm has been specializing and focusing in on is regulations at the local level. Specifically, we're tracking over 90 different cities and counties, time, place, and manner regulations, and that is the bulk of what I'm here to speak with you about today. So, House Bill 3400, quick refresher. There was a what we'll call thickly bolded box in which I think time, place, and manner regulations are allowed at the local level, and that's 1A through G here. The six licenses that were created through 3460, time, place, and manner, the way that I understand it, and for the record, I'm not an attorney. I need to say that, I guess, is that those are time, place, and manner regulations that you can, you know, in place on those licenses. And we'll go to the next slide here. So on November 4th, a legislative opinion came out talking about the definition of reasonable. And I thought this was something that would be pertinent to share in this conversation. Reasonable means not extreme or excessive. Examples of local regulations that are unreasonable include a regulation that is partial and unequal in its application to different classes, manifestly unjust, disclosed in bad faith, or so oppressive and gratuitous that a reasonable person can find no justification for the regulation. Further, it is clear from both case law and the context in which a county or city may adopt an ordinance regulating medical marijuana dispensaries that an ordinance is unreasonable if the ordinance creates a de facto ban on the establishment of medical marijuana dispensaries by imposing overly restrictive time, place, and manner regulations.
You know, you can back up just a little bit from the mic and we'll catch less feedback.
Yep. Sorry.
Great. Thank you.
And I'll get into de facto bans in a second. I've created a custom definition for that.
Okay.
So further, not only is such an ordinance so oppressive and gratuitous that a reasonable person can find no justification for the regulation, such an ordinance effectively seeks to circumvent the state law with respect to manner in which a county or city may ban the establishment of medical marijuana dispensaries. Finally, a court likely would find that such an ordinance is unreasonable on several grounds. First, because an ordinance is extreme and excessive in its regulation of medical marijuana dispensaries. Second, because such an ordinance conflicts with statutory law setting forth the legal mechanisms by which a county or city may ban the establishment of medical marijuana dispensaries. And finally, because such an ordinance is clearly in conflict with the policy of the state. So I just wanted to kind of provide that as a context for which we will start to look at what I've considered, or my firm has considered, reasonable versus unreasonable regulations. So These are some great examples of reasonable regulations. City of Beaverton, who I had the pleasure of working with hand-in-hand in helping them craft their medical marijuana dispensary regulations in such a way that it also mirrored as regulations for the recreational market. And cities that are considering or are still at the stage where they're still looking at medical regulations and rec, this is a strategy I would highly recommend. It saves you time, it's going to save you headaches, and eventually, you know, it's just going to be the way to do this because things are kind of starting to coalesce. So the city of Beaverton, reasonable regulations. Obviously, we have time. Certain zones that are allowed. Buffer zones are clearly allowed as well. 1,000 feet from public school and private school is obviously already in state statute. Additional buffers that we've seen are 500 feet from parks, daycares. So there's some churches out there that there are buffers, things of that nature. Those all seem very reasonable and allowed within time, place, and manner. Same with the city of Salem. They've got quite a few zones listed here, and again, buffer zones and times. Time, place, manner. Covered. Good regulations. And we'll just kind of, I'm trying to see if there's anything different here. More buffers, time, place, and manner, zones, city of Milwaukee, city of McMinnville, reasonable. Good. Check. Unreasonable regulations. So if you could actually go to the next slide really quickly.
Paper clicks in.
One more actually. Is there a map there? Yes. This is the city of Philomath. So definitely one of the most interesting pieces of regulation I've had the opportunity of reading. They're the only city that had a buffer that required dispensaries be within a certain boundary. There are marijuana overlay zones, but this is a concentric circle that you must operate within. So, if I could read the buffer zones. You have to be 1,500 feet from any public or private school, 1,500 feet from another facility, 500 feet from any public property not otherwise described in this section, not including right-of-way, 500 feet from the state highway, and 200 feet from a residential zone. And you must, here's the interesting part, you must be located within 2,000 feet of the Philomath Police Department. Couldn't make it up. So when you look at this map, all of the parks are inside 2,000 feet of the police department. This, I think, is a clear-cut case of a de facto ban. Now, the question becomes, was this intentional or not, right? And we have yet to really dive into the minutes of that meeting because this is kind of more the political side, and I don't get paid to do this part, but we're probably going to dive into the minutes soon. But it creates a de facto ban. And this is something that I think, you know, the legislative opinion speaks directly to. Whether it was creative or just an accident, I don't know. I won't place any blame anywhere, but this is an egregious example of what is clearly unreasonable. Okay. So we'll go to the city of Tualatin, and you just go to the next slide because there it is. So this is another interesting case where we have buffer zones of 3,000 feet from residential areas, parks, which there are about 10 of. 3,000 feet from public or private kindergarten, primary, high school, community college or university, or a combination thereof, 300 feet from any library, and 2,000 feet from another marijuana facility. So this map was created by the city of Tualatin, and that yellow area right there is the only place where you could put a medical marijuana dispensary. Now, whether or not we're going to consider reasonableness based on available property, I think is kind of a questionable area, but it is known that there is nothing viable, vacant, for lease in that area. And I do believe that when I went to the city of Tualatin city council meeting maybe a year ago when they originally proposed these, they were aware of that. And that was the reason why they enacted these regulations.
So if you could wrap up in the next minute, that'd be great. But that's interesting to see the variety of.
Okay. So let's just go skip to above and beyond unreasonable. So, I graduated from St. Helens High School, so this one was interesting to go to. On November 4th, the city council talked about and proposed passing a 15% gross sales fee for all marijuana sales within the city. I guess this was to attempt to circumvent tax But if you look at Section 34 in House Bill 3400, it says you cannot pass a tax or fee. So I presented this to the city council at the last meeting, and they've since tabled that issue. So I think that they're maybe going back and rereading some of this, which is good. The city of Reedsport, which was also brought up earlier, along with Medford and Gresham, are all considering some type of regulation that involves personal grows. That's way outside of the box, in my understanding. And in summary, Short. Important information, I promise.
Okay.
To my knowledge, there are 29 cities that have yet to rescind their local tax on medical marijuana. We all know prior to Measure 91, there were quite a bit of debates as to whether or not local cities could enact taxes, and a bunch of them did because they must have missed a section in 91 that says this is retroactive, you can't do that. And this is all information that we've actually gotten from a list from the League of Cities on places that have not rescinded their medical marijuana tax. In closing, I would like to echo support for the Association of Counties surgical opt-in language. I think that's a great way to put a toe in the door to communities that still carry some stigma but are curious as to learning more about the industry. I think that's huge, and they should have an incentive to do that. I would totally support that. And in terms of the suggestion for additional local control on top of OLCC and OHA, I don't get the sense that some of these localities are ready for that level of responsibility based on the regulations that we've talked about here today.
Well,
and I'd be happy
you.
To take any questions if you have any.
Thank you so much. Let's finish the have all the panelists speak, and then if we have questions, we'll entertain questions. Mr. Stokes.
You're off
welcome.
The hook. You did a very good job with that PowerPoint. I'm very impressed. Madam Chairs and members of the committee, my name is Noah Stokes, and I am here as founder and CEO of CannaGuard Security and as a member of the Oregon Cannabis Association. I had the opportunity to participate in the OLCC rulemaking process on one of the subcommittees, as well as be a service provider to all the parts of the cannabis industry, of the regulated cannabis industry. I've been able to see firsthand the strong steps forward this industry has made as we prepare for OLCC licensing, and I just want to really thank everybody, the OLCC and this committee, for the unpleasant job that you guys are undertaking of trying to figure out the perfect way to do this. So we appreciate that, and we understand that there's a lot of different facets here, and so I appreciate your time that you take. I'm coming at this from a perspective of just giving my opinion on some of the rules that were written and the major ones. I bet you can guess. I'm going to hit on some of the security things specifically really briefly for time reasons that are just some verbiage things that probably just need to be adjusted because the intent is clearly not how it would enact in real life. Those really quickly would be where it talks about being able to detect motion within any indoor area in the licensed premises. That would mean that there would be facilities that we originally would have installed 9 motion detectors on alarm system and would now require 80 or more to detect motion anywhere in the facility. So there's some verbiage changes because that's $10,000 in motion detectors in a facility, and I don't think that's the intent. And I have to be the one that delivers that bad news. So we'd like to limit that to limited access areas where people are going to go, not necessarily every single facility, because there's plants that grow in a room, and so I'd have to put one around the edges of the plants, and they're all moving, and it sounds terrible. Anyway, the biggest one as well would be backing up all video required video surveillance off-site. It sounds fantastic, and I think it's great to do that in limited access areas again, but to require all video surveillance recordings to be backed up off-site, most cases is not even feasible. You can't upload it to the cloud. It'd be like running 70 streams of Netflix continuously 24 hours a day on bandwidth, and most of these facilities in some of these rural areas are lucky to receive an email, let alone stream that many videos. So again, limited access areas for backing up off-site but proposing a different language for that to prevent someone from having their video surveillance stolen, to allow the OLCC to be able to regulate that properly, because without the surveillance of what happened when they're not standing there, how are they able to truly verify compliance? So there's some language that I'll submit to you guys that would be my recommendation, but the way that it's written right now is not even feasible. There's, you know, sometimes 20, 30, 40 terabytes worth of storage that are needed in these facilities that are 10,000 square feet of flower canopy, and you know, just upload that to the cloud. So, and then the last thing on security would be the ability to request the commission to waive one or more of the security requirements. I believe this is mostly for fence, you know, 8-foot fence, and some jurisdictions aren't allowed to do that. It's not necessarily my understanding that the intent is that they can say, I don't want to have cameras, or I don't want to have an alarm system, or I don't want you to be watching whatever I'm doing in my facility, because you have to be able to verify compliance with this system, which is the whole point. In a grow facility, it's not entered in the seed to sale tracking system until it's weighed after it's been, you know, trimmed and dried, and there's a lot of areas for diversion in there. So to say that we're not going to allow cameras, or allow people to not do cameras to verify that compliance, is hard. But what it's opening up, that language opens up for every single person that's going to apply to submit that they shouldn't have to do that. And it just opens, it's just, I don't think we have enough time as this many applications are going in to verify that. So just for the sake of speeding things along, maybe a language that specifies if whatever the intent of the committee is to allow for them to give an alternative, to specify that. Okay. And if it's not, to not, just for those reasons. But the main things I want to talk about would be the residency requirements, just from the perspective of our company has dealt with over 1,000 licensees, applicants and licensees in Oregon and Washington alone. Of those, we've done 400 to 500 of those. We've actually done designs for these facilities that are compliant, and had very extensive conversations with them over the last year and a half. We do a lot of work in Washington, and we've completed about 100 actual installations where an inspector has come through and inspected the facility. In those conversations, you see the big disparity from 1,000 people who have conversations to 100 that have actually been installed. It's not because, and these are all people that received an okay from the state of Washington or in Oregon, the ability to build your facility and let's go. You know, you've been approved. And having those conversations with those people that are residents of the state of Washington or residents of the state of Oregon, not one of them would say, I'm glad that I can't get money from my mother who lives in Texas or from outside the state. And I know the intent is to prevent big business and to allow Oregon to thrive, but the 900 people that weren't able to actually get their systems installed that are residents of Washington, you know, the intent is there to help Oregon residents, but what actually happens is it actually hurts them. Because there are a good amount of people that are well-funded, and even with the 49% in Oregon, it will allow professional people to attract money from out of state, and it will allow Oregon residents who happen to be wealthy to possibly take advantage of that and have their money now be worth exponentially more than someone else's simply because of where they reside. As a business owner and entrepreneur and an American, you know, I would just say to revisit that from a perspective of allowing good business practices and financial resources and back-end resources that could be lacking, especially in this industry, from coming from unregulated and a lot of times not paying taxes and not doing, you know, not dealing with OSHA and insurance and things like that, to allow people to have those resources and access to those resources to help them be successful now when they need it, versus spending their life savings trying to get open and compete for a few years against people that are much better funded with the possibility of them not being successful and losing everything. These are people that have not been able to get a loan for anything, so they're paying cash, all their hard-earned cash that they've earned over their lifetime, and probably all their loved ones and their family members that are also putting all their cash. If it doesn't work out, they're gone, they're done. And we have seen, unfortunately, a very high percentage, or a higher percentage that we like, of people that are funding it themselves that don't have access to that capital lose everything. and it's not actually helping them in turn. So I think there's a way to help Oregon residents be successful with this and to help Oregon become that industry that we want. But I just don't believe that not allowing capital and resources from out of the state of Oregon is necessarily the way to accomplish that, and I don't think that the people that are voicing their opinions are playing this forward 2 or 3 years. We can look at Washington, and I have a list of hundreds of people if you guys wanted to chat with them about the struggles and the most aggravating, stressful year of their life trying to collect the money to try and build these facilities out in a very expensive, highly regulated environment that they aren't used to and nobody's prepared for, because we're still trying to figure it out as a regulatory agency. So anyway, it's just something that is important to me. I have veterans that work for my company that have fought for American rights. We're Americans first and we're Oregonians second. And so it just rubs me the wrong way in a lot of ways to restrict something like that just because someone doesn't physically reside in the state of Oregon. So
great. Thanks. Do you have one more minute or can
nope, we? Nope, I'll let you guys go.
That was really Thank helpful. You. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Click for me, Sam?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Ms. Terziev, welcome.
Right. But thank you, yeah. See the kind of collaboration the industry has fostered. So I'll be very swift with my Nikki Terziev here on behalf of the Oregon Cannabis Business Council, small and large and medium cannabis industry businesses across the state from harvest to home. You've all heard me say this before. I'll take 30 gratuitous seconds just to talk about our mission statement. We believe that we can have a bit of cannabis industry that's going to instill confidence in consumers, in government, and in the public at large. That's what we strive for, creating transparency and accountability. Some of our membership, and we've got now 60 and growing strong as far as our members go, and I'll take 10 seconds to talk about the savvy legislative representation we offer them, and then also all of the kind of regulatory affairs that we engage with. We also provide them different services around trade association services, so helping them to grow their business in a smart way, introducing folks like Mr. Stokes here to come in and talk about what kind of ancillary service, non-advocacy-related support services are there that would help them grow their business. We're looking at, for instance, hiring and trying to find a pooled cost on an armored car service so that when folks need to make their deposit at the Department of Revenue offices here in Salem, we don't have the issue of 3 o'clock p.m., and by the way, it's public information. We should probably look at that. At 3 o'clock p.m., I'm going to be down walking in for my appointment at the DOR with my duffel bag. So just small things like that that will kind of help the government, the industry. This is a did goods, maybe do betters. Did goods, legislative and regulatory responsiveness. You know, I think we, the industry, and you and the agencies, we all worked well together. And I'd echo Mr. Stokes' sentiment on that one. Collaboration and compromise, certainly within the industry, we compromised and we collaborated and did the best that we could to help everybody, including yourselves, come up with the most workable, successful industry model as we work to roll out what could be the best in the nation. Working with local governments, things like the Lux, things like responsiveness from, for instance, Portland City Council as the industry showed up and talked with them. I'd say for the most part, some of the comments from the League of Oregon Cities today, maybe a little bit nerve-wracking, but I'm sure we can work through that as well. And finally, just taking a big leap. I think we all did it. We did it together, and it was great. Do betters. Timing of licenses and availability of licensed products could drive the black market. You know, what we're looking at is about a six-month or a two-quarter lag in between the license being handed over to production and then the license handed over for sales. I'm not sure sitting here from this vantage point what the answer is other than asking producers to wait to produce, which then creates a lag in the market when the retail sales go open. So that's something I think we should think about. Present limits on medibles and future edibles. One of the things that the Cannabis Business Council would suggest is removing the cap on medibles. Take the cap on content off of the medibles and put it in another case, put it in another room. If you start to divide your operation by product and potency versus licensure type, you may be getting to what we're afraid of, which is someone from the general public getting their hands on an RSO. But it also doesn't force somebody who's using it as medicine, a cancer patient, for instance, to eat down 5 chocolate bars to get their half daily dose. Removing the taxation on patients. I think you've heard a lot about this. The OHA graphs that you saw earlier today show that they peaked and medical dispensary registration is going down. I think that we're going to find, I'm assuming we're going to find, that a lot of the medical dispensaries and growers and production facilities are going to opt into the retail market, and that creates a gap for those who need their medicine. So having a place where a retail shop can sell to a patient for their medicine without taxation on the patients. The retail systems are set up for it presently, so if I as a patient would walk in and show my card, it's just rung up without that taxation piece. And then just some clarification on Senate Bill 460 around other things that could be sold in the shop. I did have a few moments with Shannon just to have some of the clarification conversations. Sounds like we'll be rolled out a little more in detail in March in the rules. But our question was kind of, gee, what about a non-cannabis product or something with THC that's less than 0.03%, lip balm, something that is CBD, is not THC. I think looking at in something that's made with industrial hemp, and certainly then just getting the clarification on record, the answer to what if I sell a T-shirt or what if I sell a water pipe? Am I infringing on some gray zone in the law? So looking for clarification at that, and it sounds like we'll get it. So other business, I'm going to go big and then go home. Co-location considerations. And a possible marijuana commission. I am not suggesting in any way, shape, or form that we tackle this tonight, tomorrow. I'd say probably in 2016. These are big bite conversations. But looking at the motion of the market and looking at how co-location can best serve all Oregonians, including medical patients, it's something that we're interested in having the conversation around. And then a marijuana commission. in the OLCC, but something that's dedicated. We've appreciated our partnership with the agency and would like to see that continued, but if we can have some bifurcated conversation and start relying on more of the industry's expertise and looking less and less to mirror liquor laws as we grow and as we move forward, it might be an ideal situation.
Great. Thank you so much, all of you. You know, we have one panel remaining that has gotten short-shrifted time-wise. So do people within that context have a question that they'd like to pose to this panel? Yes, Representative Buckley.
Just, I would welcome ideas on co-location. If there's proposals, I'm intrigued by the idea to have a ability for a patient to buy without taxation. That seems very simple. Also, the idea of having a separate room for medical marijuana, that seems very doable as well. Maybe that's under OHA supervision and the rest of the facilities under OLCC. There's got to be a way to do it. I hope the industry comes forward with some proposals for us in February.
Thank you.
Excellent. Any other comments? Yes, please.
Thank you. Sam, thank you for bringing the information about the time, manner, and place regulations and the differences among jurisdictions that are going on out there. This is a comment more than a question. In my view, these are land use regulations. My view as a land use practitioner was that as a committee, we devolved a lot of authority to the local governments to have flexibility to adopt time, manner, place regulations if they stayed in the system, and to do it in a way that allowed these businesses. If you didn't want it, opt out. That flexibility can be taken away, and it has been taken away in the land use statutes that I'm familiar with and have dealt with through the years. And when the legislature dials down on additional direction, the laws become very prescriptive very fast. And then we get complaints, and I think oftentimes legitimate, from our counties and cities telling us, you've been too prescriptive and our hands are tied. Here are these unintended consequences. So whenever I am out talking about land use legislation and now marijuana legislation, my message is to local governments, don't get too cute, because you might be doing the reverse of what you actually think you're doing.
Okay. Thank you. You know, I would say, Mr. Stokes, I just want to note that what I heard you say about the residency requirement is that you've met in your work in Washington and Oregon a whole lot of people who would have implemented some best practices and some security measures to prevent diversion and couldn't afford it because they didn't have access to the capital to do it. And they're trying not to use capital that is from a source that would be problematic or questionable. And they're trying to spread, and so they need straight up lawful capital from some lawful source. And they also want to spread the risk of starting a new business, you know, and they might be able to spread it by granting equity interests in their business to various, you know, friendly people who pass a background check. But if we don't let them do that, then the whole risk of starting a new business is on an individual, which makes the hurdle to starting a new and legitimate business even greater. So I think that your firsthand experience talking to customers is helpful in that regard. Thank you, panel, so much for your time. And thank you in particular to John Galvin and Lauren Henderson from Department of Revenue and Department of Agriculture, respectively. If you could please join us at the front. We're excited to hear about the work that you're undertaking, and we really appreciate your patience as we work through this big agenda. Which of you would like to go first?
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Leininger. This is Lauren Henderson. I'm the Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and I'll go first. I went last time. One, I admire the committee's stamina. It's, you all do really well in these long hearings. I was asked to present two areas. One is how we're doing with our pesticide criteria and the list for cannabis, and then as well to chat just for a couple of minutes on the Oregon Farm Bureau and Oregon Association of Nursery day that they had in October. I think it was October 14th. So I'll do that quickly and then save time for questions. So we're, I think the last time I was here, I talked that we were progressing through the criteria for pesticides that could be used on cannabis, as well as then producing a guide list. I've asked a handout. I think you all have one page of a label. That happens to be a one page of six. And the reason why I brought that particular one is that that is a place where we start. If you'll notice on that label, there should be a highlighted area. And one of the things it says is this can be used. It's a pest and disease pesticide, and it can be used on agricultural crops. Given that we've talked that there are not registered products specifically for marijuana, we had to then turn to label review that had a broad use. Agriculture crops is a very broad use. And so that started our pesticide staff on working off of Washington's list through the 12,448 products that we have to get to a spot where we narrowed that down for those that had a broad enough use that we felt they could be used for anything, including cannabis. And so that's where we started. In addition to that, we looked that they had the active ingredient had to be exempt from a food tolerance. The EPA sets those food tolerance, and those tolerances are set that allow a certain residue limit on that product, and it is determined that if it's under that it can be marketed and it's not a level of concern. By the fact that we've exempted it from that tolerance, that says that EPA has done all of the scientific exposure and toxicity studies that said that that particular product poses no risk or harm, and so it doesn't need the tolerance. It's therefore exempt. The label includes directions for use on, and you can see there in this particular label, it says agricultural crops. Those are unspecified. If you were to have the whole label, you would see all kinds of uses on that label and suggestions for that particular label. And then the last bullet point really gets to the inhalation part of this, and that the data from EPA and the studies that have been done said that particular product is not a level of concern for that. So where did that lead us? That led us to, and this is just one page of our guide list. I don't know if you can see it very well. But that is what the producers would see on our website when we get it up. It's, I think, 250-some products. We tried to provide the basic information through the first six categories to meet the criteria. And then the rest of it to the right there is just some other helpful information that we hope they'll use as they do that. I can tell you we want to get the guide list up as soon as we can. One thing we thought was prudent to do, Director Koba initiated a call with the Director of Washington and the Director of Colorado to have a tri-state meeting. We're working on getting that done very quickly. They're grappling with the same issues in their states, and we just thought it would be beneficial if our three states were talking to each other at that level, that if one state did one thing, we're all getting calls, Colorado did this, why can't you do this, that we would be more unified. I also think it will help with our discussions with EPA as they move forward with this. The other thing that I wanted to mention very quickly is we do have an established web page for cannabis that will have our programs. It's an entry point for folks to our agency. We have hired our cannabis coordinator, Sunny Jones, and so we'll have a full-time person working on this and helping our agency help others. Lastly, just briefly, Representative Helm was at this day. It was a day hosted by the Oregon Farm Bureau and the Oregon Association of Nurseries. It was well attended. I don't know the exact count, but it was somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 people. It was a good opportunity for about five or six state agencies, I think, to not only introduce themselves but present some things for people to think about if they were going into this business. I think the guidebook has replicated that information. For our part, it really was a chance for folks to see our agency. We did it in a little bit different format, kind of the view format, question and answer amongst our staff. The key take-home points, we tried to be as brief as we could in our weights and measures program, is that they had to have a licensed approved scale. Our food safety program, it was to prevent food illness. Our pesticides was the label is the law, and we want people to read those labels and follow them. And then our egg water quality program, that their activities cannot negatively impact water quality. Our plant health and our certification programs, pest and disease issues. We've had a few calls where people have had a pest or disease and want a little more information about that. We're able to provide that. And then our voluntary programs through certification. We've had a lot of folks interested in some kind of organic certification. And so nothing has really come forward in that arena organized yet, but we do have staff that can assist with that. I put Director Koba's take-home message and kind of intro here. I really think this reflects where our agency is today, which is the welcome to the family. That's really how we view the cannabis industry, and really excited to work with them. And we have a lot to learn as an agency, and are excited to do that. So I'll close with that.
Thank you. That's great. Thanks a lot. Yeah. I'm going to invite you to give your remarks now, too, and then we'll ask questions at the end. Thank you, Mr. Galvin.
Good afternoon, Madam Co-Chair, my members of the committee. My name is John Galvin. I'm the Marijuana Tax Program Manager at the Department of Revenue.
Do you have a slide?
I do, yeah. Is that on there? You going to click through this for me, Lauren?
Oh, sure.
Thanks. This afternoon, I'd like to provide an update where we are with implementation of the marijuana tax and some of the challenges that we're running into, including cash handling. So to provide a brief background, Measure 91, voters legalized the production and sale of recreational marijuana in 2014. July 1st, 2015, it became legal for adults 21 and over to consume and possess limited amounts of recreational marijuana. The 2015 legislature enacted a provision allowing temporary recreational sales by medical marijuana dispensaries beginning October 1st of 2015, although it is important to remember that without a current tax structure in place, all marijuana-related products are sold tax-free until January 4th, 2016. And we will be dealing with eventually two tax rates. You can see the middle column there is the temporary tax on the medical dispensaries. That will start January 4th of 2016. at 25% with the 2% the business can retain for administration, and limited eligible products, seeds, dried leaves, flowers, and non-flowering plants. When the retail tax starts, we don't know exactly when. We believe it's late 2016. Will be a 17% tax, again the 2% amount the business can retain for administration, and it will include a few additional products that can be sold, including edibles, concentrates, skin and hair products. The filing frequency for both will be quarterly. The payment frequency by rule will be monthly. Filing method for the temporary tax on medical dispensaries will be paper only, and for retail tax revenue online only. So that will be in our new, involved in our new core system replacement. End date for the temporary tax on the medical dispensaries is December 31st of 2016. So some of the challenges we're facing is marijuana is still classified as a Schedule I drug. Time being the second challenge. Revenue was late to the game. We got involved in May, and being ready has been somewhat of a challenge. Although the main message, if you take away anything from this, is that we will be ready to accept payments and bank those funds. Another challenge is the industry's availability to bank funds. And that brings an anticipated abundance of cash for us. Continuing with the challenges, we believe we're dealing with a lot of unknowns right now. And there's uncertainty around electronic payments. So currently what we know is that taxpayers will have the availability to pay in cash or with a check for February when their payments are due. So other factors we're considering, along with our main priority of safety and security for everyone involved in this, is the location, security appointments, the dollar limit, frequency of payments, staffing, funding, and contamination. We're working through three emergency rules, cash handling procedures, registration, and payment due dates. And we are working on both a temporary and a permanent cash handling solution. The reason we're working on both goes back to our challenge of time. We did not have time to get a permanent cash handling solution up and ready to go by the time payments will be due. We're working on recruitments and hirings, forms and publication design, integrating marijuana into our Gentex, our new computer system, and outreach to taxpayers and stakeholders. And that is what we're working on.
That's fantastic. That's great. Thank you so much for that. Do we have any questions for this panel? Just an abundance of gratitude, it looks like. As we wrap up this marathon meeting to which so many of you came and stayed, I want to thank you for being here. Also note that we do have another Legislative Days meeting coming up, and that will be in January. So January 13th to 16th is the next installment of these pre-session interim legislative days, and then this short session starts in early February. So we'll do another update then, and then the session that happens is about 6 weeks. So the way that plays out is typically there's not room for a lot of really controversial stuff. We have to kind of meet our minds as much as we can in advance to have a chance of getting something passed. So as we contemplate things you need and things we need to do, part of the framework is going to be that short sessions are generally for things that people can feel comfortable agreeing upon quickly. And then the long session is going to be in 2017 starting in February. So please keep us posted on things you need. We all want to be receptive to community input, agency input. In our next Legislative Days session, Ginny, Senator Burdick is going to chair the meeting, and we'll get an agenda out well in advance. And thank you again, everyone, for being here, and happy birthday, Rob Patridge. And the meeting is adjourned. The meeting is adjourned. Happy birthday, Rob Patridge. And the meeting is adjourned.